The title of this book is The Dolphin Connection. It was written by Beryl Bainbridge and narrated by Anna Bronowski.
About this Daisy book. This Daisy book has been produced by converting an existing analog recording. It may contain references to and artifacts of the original tape recording. This book may be structured using two levels. Level 1 containing each main heading and level 2 each subheading. This converted recording may contain page numbers that do not match the original print version. If it does not contain page numbers, you can still navigate by using all other features of your Daisy player. Book information.
This edition was published by Collins Dove of North Blackburn, Victoria, in 1991. ISBN 0859249360. This recording has been made in the Audio Production Unit of the Royal Blind Society, Enfield, New South Wales, in 1992, and has been sponsored by the Rotary Club of Blackheath. It consists of a story. From the book jacket, quote, "Suddenly she felt herself being lifted up and propelled forward at what seemed an incredible speed. As she put her hand down and felt something cool and slippery beneath her, Midge realized that she was being carried by a dolphin." End of quote. It's summer. Midge isn't interested in going to the beach with the regular crowd. She is absorbed by the haunting music of the panpipes across the bay. She meets Chris Manane for the first time, and together they are drawn into a web of intrigue and danger. Before the summer is over, both Chris and Midge owe their lives and happiness to a family of dolphins. The Dolphin Connection. Inside the wide-mouthed cave, the dolphin rocked gently in the green swell. With half-closed eyes, his head resting on a smooth ledge of rock, he lay quite still, listening. The sound of panpipes had come to him as he fed with the others out in the bay, and, as always, it had lured him away. For him, even when he was hungry, this music was irresistible. Chris Manane, his curly hair still wet after a swim, watched the dolphin as he played his pipes perched on a rock ledge a few metres inside the cave entrance. He rested back easily, his bare brown legs dangling in the water. A handsome boy, with strong yet sensitive features and a well-built body, he looked older than his 16 years. He played the pipes with practiced ease, the sweet, breathy notes echoing around the cave walls, and the haunting melody was his own. Mitch Beaumont decided as soon as she woke up that she didn't want to go to the barbecue lunch party at the Wilsons' new pool that day. The same old crowd would be there and the same boring chatter. She'd much rather go down to the cove and read her new book. It would be nice and quiet there. With everyone up at the Wilsons, there'd be no ski boats zooming around, at least for a couple of hours. Midge, 15, and small for her age, but lively, was the latest recruit to the Outer Bay mob. The 10 of them, mostly in their late teens now, had all grown up together in Sydney, and their parents, being long-time friends, had established their own holiday resort near the ocean entrance to what they called Outer Bay. The Beaumont's beach house was the last to be finished, and Midge and her parents had moved in only a week ago. Midge was in the kitchen eating a chicken sandwich when her mother came in. She looked elegant in slacks and a new red and white striped shirt. "Well, I'm off now," she said breezily. But as she reached Midge, Hilary Beaumont's voice softened. "Won't you change your mind and come, dear?" Hilary ruffled her daughter's hair affectionately. Swallowing a mouthful of chicken, Midge shook her head determinedly. "Nope." Then, seeing her mother's disappointed frown, "I'm freaked out, Mum. Really. It's been one great big buzz all week, ever since we got here. I'd just like a few hours to myself away from the mob, that's all." "But that sounds so ungrateful, Midge. After all, they did turn on a great welcoming party for you, didn't they?" Midge sighed. "Yes, I know, Mum. They're a great bunch, really, and I enjoy being with them, but not all the time. Well, not today, anyway." Midge looked up at her mother appealingly. Listening to her mother's retreating footsteps tap-tapping quickly across the patio, Midge knew she hadn't understood, and wished she could have told her the real reason why she was backing out of the Wilsons' pool party. Slowly, Midge's fingers curled around the frayed right leg of her shorts, an old pair of cut-down jeans, lifting it up to reveal the dark strawberry birthmark on her upper thigh. "No, I think Mum's forgotten all about you, Wiggy," she muttered, as she touched the raised, irregularly shaped mark. "I wish to God I could." An only child, Midge had often been lonely when she was a little girl. She had been so fascinated by the mark that she used to talk to it as she did to her dolls, stroking it and patting it affectionately. To Midge, it was a nice someone, with a fat, smiling face and funny big ears, one a bit bigger than the other, and so she'd named it Wiggy. Everything she possessed always had to have a name. But Midge had soon learned that other people, her mother especially, didn't like Wiggy at all, even though it was never quite put that way. Every time Mrs. Beaumont saw Midge pulling up her dress in order to talk to Wiggy, she'd frown, then say quite crossly, "Put your clothes down, Midge. Wiggy doesn't like you doing that, you know." And when Midge assured her one day that she knew he did because his smile got bigger when she talked to him, her mother said, "Well, I don't like you doing it, Midge. Neither does Daddy, and neither does anyone else, so don't do it." After that, Midge rarely talked to Wiggy, and then only very quietly. Then, the day she started preschool, she suddenly hated Wiggy, and she made sure that no one ever saw him. And nobody would see him today, either, Midge was thinking now. Maybe she was just being stupid, passing up a great party just because she felt a bit self-conscious. Up until now, no one had seemed to care a hoot what she wore to swim or water ski in, usually cut-off jeans over an old-style one-piece with elasticized legs, so that Wiggy wouldn't show. But today would be different. Sandy Wilson and the others would all be wearing their smartest swimming gear. And, with the styles briefer than ever this year, she'd stand out like a sore thumb, even in her best blue one-piece. She'd look a real prude. "Well, what of it?" Midge asked herself. "The mob know I'm not a prude. Well, maybe I am, just a bit. Anyway, today they'd accept me as the usual me, whatever I wore." Midge frowned. "Maybe I should go, after all." "No, better leave it as it is," she decided. "It'll only make things worse if I turn up now. But I won't chicken out next time, that's for sure." Suddenly she felt much better, even quite cheerful, as she tidied up the kitchen, then ran upstairs to her room to get her book. The little cove, sheltered by the cliff and just around from the ocean beach, was Midge's favourite reading place. And today she'd bought a book on Greek mythology, a subject that had excited her ever since last year's fabulous trip to Greece with her parents. Midge was absorbed in her book when suddenly she became aware that the distant panpipe music she heard was real and not part of the ancient world of myth she'd wandered into in her imagination. This music seemed so right for it, though. It was uncanny. But then, if it was Chris Minane playing, it wasn't so surprising. After all, she'd heard that he had lived in Greece, and on her favourite island, Hydra. His father was English, a doctor and marine biologist who studied dolphins, and they lived across in Tunnel Bay, the inner of the two small bays. Now, hearing his music, Midge was more interested than ever. She very much wanted to meet Chris Minane. She sat up and looked towards the narrow channel between tall cliffs that almost met, dividing the two bays. She could see that the dark points of rock in the channel were still being splashed by white spray as the sea rushed through into Tunnel Bay. "It must be close to high tide," Midge thought, judging by the water level against the cliffs. Very soon now, the rush of water would slow, then stop altogether. Midge wasn't sure for how long, but she thought it was about half an hour before the tide turned. Yes, there should be time. Already her heart raced at the thought of what she planned to do. "The boat's still at the jetty. She's new, so nothing should go wrong," Midge assured herself. "Dad'll probably skin me alive, but I never really promised not to take the boat out alone," she shrugged. "There's no other way, anyhow." Because of the rocky shoreline around the bay and patches of impenetrable scrub up on the cliffs, no one could get into the inner bay except through the narrow channel entrance. But even that was forbidden territory, being considered far too dangerous. It wasn't called the tunnel for nothing. Midge knew that the sea was very deep there, and so full of rocks and mad, cascading water that only at high tide was it possible to take a boat through it all. But John Wilson and Bill Lumridge had done it, so why shouldn't she? Midge shut her book, grabbed her beach towel, and ran towards the jetty. Chris had known Titch would be the first dolphin to arrive. The few minutes of sharing music together before the others came was a special time for them both. Chris had known and loved dolphins since babyhood, but never one so intelligent or with such an intense love of music as Titch. Music was not all these two had shared in the past few years. They were so close now that each knew instinctively how the other was feeling, and by transmitting thoughts in pictured form, they could communicate in quite an extraordinary way. Titch knew that his friend was not happy, and that his playing was helping him now. Music spoke a language that both could understand. And it was music that had first brought them together. Now, as he played, Chris turned his thoughts back to that day. Titch, only a young calf then, had actually led his mother to this cave the first time he'd played the pipes here. It was his 11th birthday, and only a few weeks after they'd moved into Cliffhurst. That day he'd won the under-12 sprint and the high jump at his new school's sports day, and he was feeling great. But coming home on the bus, all he could think of was the dolphins he'd seen out in the bay the day before. Would they be there again today? He could hardly wait to see. Chris covered the long track in from the road to the house in record time and arrived puffed out. "Are they still there, Dad?" he shouted from the veranda. His father, concreting new steps halfway down the cliff, looked up grinning and called back with a nod and a wave. "Yes, been there all day." Chris grabbed his new panpipes and hurried down to the cave. Although he wasn't very good at playing them yet, he hoped the dolphins just might come if they heard him. He could hardly believe it when the little dolphin arrived a few minutes later. But Chris kept on playing as he watched it swim into the cave quite fearlessly, wagging its head and chattering excitedly with squeaks of delight. He could see its mother just outside the entrance, but she came in, responding to her calf's urgent clickings. They should both have names, Chris thought. So, from then on, the baby was Titch and its mother, Marnie, called after two characters in one of his favourite books. He played his pipes again the next day. This time, four dolphins came to the cave. Marnie had brought along her shy friend, Mary, with her offspring. Such a playful clown he was that he had to be called Bobo. And finally, Rex, leader of the dolphin pod, joined the music lovers group and soon became an enthusiastic regular with the others at the video and communication sessions that Chris's father began soon afterwards in the big cave directly behind this one. Chris and his father had found Tunnel Bay, the caves and the old cliff house, quite by accident. They'd bought some takeaway at a roadhouse a few kilometres back, and were driving slowly, looking for a good place to have lunch somewhere off the road, when Chris spotted the turnoff, just a sandy track with no sign up.
"Let's go in, Dad," he said. "It could lead to the beach. Maybe a house, too."
Looking for a place to live in a strange new country had been great, just the sort of mysterious adventure he loved. The bumpy track led them over sand and rock through nearly a kilometre of thickly timbered scrub before they came to a rusty gate in a ramshackle fence, and over the gate, burnt deep into the crossbeam, was the name Cliffhurst. It was a nice name, Chris thought. Beyond the fence, a sandy track led up fairly steeply through bushland that had been thinned out a bit. But there was no sign of any house, so they decided to eat first and then drive in. There was sure to be a house up there somewhere.
"The kind of people choosing to live here might be quite interesting to meet," his father sounded enthusiastic. "And if visitors aren't welcome, then we'll just go away and leave them in peace."
It was as they rounded a bend, where the track levelled out into a clearing, that they caught sight of the small rock-strewn bay below, and stopped. The bay was almost a circle, with sharp rocks rising from the shoreline to cliffs topped with thick scrub. Chris remembered how calm the water had been that day, very blue, except for dark patches where there were reefs of rocks below. His father had the binoculars out and was staring towards the narrow channel opening. "There must be an outer bay through there, Chris," he said. "The water in this one is just too calm for it to be otherwise." It was then that Chris caught his breath suddenly at what he saw out in the bay. "Look, Dad!" he shouted, pointing. "Dolphins!" His father had seen them too. "Yes, a family, I'd say," he said in his calm, pleased voice. "And feeding, by the look of them." They watched the dolphins for a while. Then Chris, glancing around, saw the old timber house. Its solid, wide verandas seemed to beckon him, wanting to share their secrets. Strong and safe, the old house stood up there on the cliff, guarding the bay like some mysterious, friendly fortress. Suddenly, Chris knew he didn't want to look any more for a place to live. He wanted to live in that house. In fact, he loved everything about this place, the rocky bay, the dolphins, and now the house. "Oh, yes," Chris told himself, "this house must be for us." Excitedly, he nudged his father, pointing. "What a great house, Dad! The best yet, don't you think?" he added hopefully. The possibility that the house might not even be for sale had never entered his head. Remembering, Chris smiled. What a naive kid he'd been! He glanced down at Titch, who still lay quietly listening. Then, as he began a new lilting tune, he sent his mind racing back again. His father hadn't smiled. He'd just nodded, staring up at the house. "It's got possibilities," was all he'd said. Then he'd grinned down at him. "Let's go up and see if anyone's home, eh?" But when they got closer, they found the house all locked up, and it was obvious that no one had lived in it for some time. After that, they had gone down the steps cut into the cliff and explored along the rocks for a while. Discovering the large cave near the point had been exciting, and then, better still, an even larger secret cave behind it. They'd never have known it was there if Chris hadn't climbed up to see what was behind the hole high in the back wall. Finding that secret cave had clinched it. His father was just as excited about that as he was. "Damn it! You're right, Chris. This is the best yet," he said, grinning down at him, gripping his shoulder tightly. "We'll have to find out who owns the house, eh? Let's hope they're willing to sell." Chris remembered crossing his fingers, hoping hard for that too. Tunnel Bay, they learned that night from an old fisherman in a pub in the next town, wasn't even marked on any map. Eager for a yarn with the strangers, the old chap had brought his beer over to their table, where they were having a counter tea. And he knew the house, of course. "Tom Ferguson built that place. Years ago, that was. Could be 50. Queer sort of bloke," he told them. "But he left a couple of years back, when his wife got crook." He took a long swig of beer. "Does he still own it, do you know?" asked Chris's father. The old chap put down his glass and gave his mouth a quick wipe, impatient to get on with his story. "How the hell would I know?" he growled. "But that tunnel now. I only ever went there the once, but that's enough, I can tell you. There's twin bays there." He waved a gnarled brown hand. "Well, you'd have seen 'em yourself. Shaped something like a figure eight, sort of, with the top and the middle chewed out, right?" They had nodded at that, and pleased with the attention he was getting, the old chap went on. "Well, there's a real deep channel between them two bays." He was getting properly warmed up then. "Yes, I've seen the tide racing through that channel like you wouldn't believe. Quite scary it was, with eddies and whirlpools whizzing round in real choppy water, just like that white water stuff they race down in canoes on the telly." He shook his head. "Struth! I wouldn't like to get caught in that water. Wouldn't last a minute." Again he shook his head. "Must be one of the wildest spots of any along the New South Wales coast, I'd say. No one ever goes near the place, and I don't blame 'em." That white water part of the old man's story had sounded really exciting, and Chris knew his father would be keener than ever to buy Cliffhurst now.
He remembered his father telling him, coming over in the plane, why he needed some really out-of-the-way place for the work he planned to do with wild dolphins in Australia. Having people about would be too much of a distraction for the dolphins, and that would hinder the whole project. A few days after they'd discovered Cliffhurst, they managed to track down the owner through a real estate agent in Newcastle. His wife had died, and being well over 70 and crippled with arthritis, he was only too willing to sell. Chris suddenly stopped playing, and Titch began to splash about, clapping his flippers with squeaks of encouragement for him to keep on. Sell. The word had jolted Chris back to the present. Something he'd come down to the cave to try and forget. They were coming sometime tomorrow, the two men who might buy Cliffhurst. The very thought of having to leave this place made him feel sick, but it was inevitable. His father was now too ill to carry on. The attractive receptionist watched, smiling, as the first of the two new arrivals signed the hotel guest register. The man was tall and thin, with dark receding hair. He wore thick-lensed glasses. In careful, pointed letters, he entered the name Gerard J. Feldman. His gaunt face was expressionless as he stood aside for his burly companion, who signed with a flourish, Stefan R. Brunston. Then he looked up at the receptionist, and his toothy, inviting smile beamed at her as he smoothed down well-oiled auburn hair in a self-conscious gesture. The receptionist quickly looked away, trying not to show her distaste. Half an hour later, in the almost deserted upstairs guest lounge, the two men were sitting at a table in the far corner, their drinks in front of them as they talked quietly. "It was a good thing, then, that Carl answered the telephone," Gerard Feldman said in the heavily accented English of one unfamiliar with the language. "That Rita, she talks too much." He picked up his glass. "Did you remember to ask about the medication?" Stefan Brunston obviously resented his fellow countryman's autocratic tone. "Of course, but Dr. Munane is no better," he says. "Well, that is no surprise to us, eh?" Gerard Feldman replied with a thin, secretive smile. "Does Carl suspect, do you think?" "No, I am sure not," Stefan Brunston sipped his drink. "In fact, he sounded quite concerned about the doctor's state of health. It seems that he grows so tired, even through the day, that he has to rest." Stefan sipped again. "He was resting when I rang." "You sympathized, I hope," Gerard said sardonically. "And you verified that we were expected tomorrow." "Yes, yes," was Stefan's petulant reply. "Why must you always question me in that tone? I am not a child." He gulped down his drink. "At 2 o'clock we will arrive. I have arranged it so, as we agreed." Thinking of the two men from the Matros Mammal Research Institute in France, or MMRI, as it was known, who were coming, Chris wondered what they would be like. Uncle Alan had barely mentioned them, so they couldn't be friends of his. It was then that Chris heard the buzz of a speeding boat engine. It certainly wasn't their boat. The motor was in Newcastle, for repairs. It must be someone from Outer Bay, he thought. It was slack tide, the only time it was possible to go through the tunnel gap. But so far, only two from Outer Bay had been game enough to do it. The boat seemed to be coming closer when the engine suddenly slowed down, idled for a bit, then cut out altogether. Chris grinned. Whoever it was must have had second thoughts about coming through the tunnel after all, and he didn't blame him. Chris started to play again, choosing a much quicker tune. And this time he'd think about Uncle Alan, who'd gone home to his London flat to do some more dabbling on the stock exchange. Uncle Alan was a whiz at that, and must have made a fortune. Chris had always liked his Uncle Alan, a charming Englishman with an infectious enthusiasm for life and living. He seemed to spend most of his time overseas these days, in all kinds of fascinating out-of-the-way places that Chris never tired of hearing about. His father had only just begun to set things up when Uncle Alan had arrived in a spanking new hired Porsche.
That first time, he'd treated his young brother's dolphin project as a bit of a joke, saying that, as a medical doctor to start with, Paul should stick to doctoring and not go off playing with dolphins. But on his next visit, more than 2 years later, he seemed quite intrigued by the dolphin project and very impressed both with the results and the scientific acclaim that his now famous brother, Dr. Paul Manane, was receiving for his work. But in the past year, the strain of having to write scientific papers and reports, as well as doing most of the work with the dolphins, had taken its toll on Paul's health, already weakened by a bad accident 7 years ago. He badly needed outside help, but wouldn't admit it, and had stubbornly refused to take any medication, although he was often in pain. "You're help enough, Chris," his father told him. "But you're doing more than your share already. You should be spending more time with your mates." But working with the dolphins was what Chris wanted to do most. They seemed to accept him completely now, and when he was with them, he felt that he was one of them. But even though he spent nearly all his free time helping, it still wasn't enough. So, when he turned 16, he'd begged to leave school and work full-time with the dolphins, but his father wouldn't hear of it. "It would be sheer insanity," he said, "especially when you're doing so well. You're topping every damned subject." Chris had tried to interrupt, but his father wouldn't be stopped. "And what about your sporting career?" he went on. "State junior champion in the 1500 metres and the 800 metres, and heading for the next Olympics in both. How the hell could you keep up with the training?" "I could still fit that in somehow, Dad," he'd tried to assure him. His father was hardly ever angry, but he certainly was then. "What utter nonsense! You know damned well you couldn't. The answer is no. You can't leave school, and that's final." It was Uncle Alan who had finally managed to persuade his father to change his mind about extra help. "Look, you've just got to face it, Paul," he said as the three of them sat on the wide veranda the night he arrived. "You can't carry on here without help. But hiring locals isn't the answer. You don't want them gossiping all over the place, I imagine." "No, I certainly don't," Dr. Manane replied. After that, they'd listened with interest to Uncle Alan's story about how the young waiter at a Corsican holiday resort had overheard him telling Brunston and Feldman, the two men at his table, about his famous brother's work with wild dolphins in Australia, and that he was about to pay him another visit. "As a matter of fact, we were still talking about you and your dolphins an hour later," Uncle Alan told them, laughing. "I've never had such an interested audience. I even had quite a hard time putting them off coming over with me to have a look for themselves." "Why were they so interested? Who were they?" Paul asked. Alan laughed. "Both marine scientists from MMRI, would you believe? I've got their cards somewhere. They said they still want to come, by the way." "Well, I hope you didn't shoot your mouth off too much, Alan," Paul said, not sounding too pleased. "I want to keep this thing quiet, you know." "Yes, you told me that, and don't worry, little brother. I purposely left out all the details," Alan assured him. Then he went on to tell them how the young waiter, Carl Rimmer, had brought his wife Rita to him later. She worked as assistant chef in the same resort. Both wanted to come to Australia and work, but needed visas. They were willing to do anything. Could he help? "Do you know, Paul, the Rimmers could well be what you need here," Alan said. "They seemed a very decent pair. They're young and would keep to themselves in a new country," he went on. "And, being so desperate to get here, they'd both work their heads off in gratitude," he laughed. "Look, I've got the Rimmer's address somewhere. Why not give them a go, eh?" Alan's powers of persuasion being considerable, Paul gave in at last, and the Rimmers arrived several months later, on a month's trial. Chris hadn't taken to Carl at the start. Perhaps it was the way he never quite looked at him when he spoke. But his father liked him. He was a good worker and seemed reliable. Chris wondered where he'd learned to speak English so well. He couldn't quite pick the accent, and Carl had hedged when he'd been asked about it and what nationality they were. Rita, whose English they could barely understand, was dark-haired and quite pretty, but Chris thought she seemed a bit of a flirt at first.
She certainly knew how to use those big dark eyes and giggled a lot. Nevertheless, she'd turned out to be an excellent cook, and it was great to have decent meals for a change. Meals! Chris suddenly realized how hungry he was. That morning he'd skipped breakfast, feeling like a swim instead. Then he remembered that Rita had asked him to get a few abalone for their visitor's dinner tomorrow. He'd better do it now. As he reached up to put his pipes into a crevice in the cave wall, Titch swam up to him. He knew the concert was over.
"Well, Titch," Chris leaned over to give the dolphin an affectionate pat, "I'm going down after some abalone. How about finding a new cluster for us, eh?"
Titch didn't need to be asked twice. The underwater picture Chris had given him of big abalone clinging to the rocks had been enough. And, after frisking about delightedly, Titch dashed out of the cave and disappeared. Laughing, Chris slid down into the water. He picked up the heavy net bag and knife lying on the rock ledge, slipped the bag handle over his shoulders, and, with the knife between his teeth, swam out after the dolphin. Midge was thanking her lucky stars. Coming through that channel had been really scary, but she'd managed it, thank goodness. And she'd been delighted when a small group of friendly dolphins had come to meet her, leaping about and keeping pace with the boat. But then, suddenly, they'd hung back, and she was sorry to see them go. Once in the shelter of the cliff, Midge switched off the motor to listen, and was still not sure where the music was coming from when suddenly it stopped. Then she saw a dolphin come out from the cave entrance, and someone swimming out after it with what looked like a knife between his teeth. Unsure of what to do, she watched as the swimmer suddenly duck-dived and stayed under. He'd been down for more than a minute when she was relieved to see his head come up briefly before he dived again. Then she started the motor and headed the boat towards the spot where he'd disappeared. Chris was 4 meters down against the cliff and bagging his third abalone when he heard the boat engine again, and coming fast too, judging by the noise reverberating through the water. Curious to see who it was, he was tempted to go up. No, just one more, he thought, as he began to prise a fourth abalone from its rock, digging in hard with his knife. Midge shut the throttle right down and was idling the boat towards the cliff and a clear space between the rocks when the dolphin surfaced a few meters away, squeaking and chattering happily. Midge was startled by its sudden appearance, but even more startling was the bag of abalone draped around its neck.
"Handy fishing, mate, isn't he?" called a laughing voice behind her.
Midge cut the motor as she turned to see a curly-haired boy perched on a rock, grinning at her. "This must be Chris Manane," she was thinking as she smiled back.
"Yes, he certainly is,"
Midge laughed when the dolphin rose up out of the water and began to tail-walk backwards.
"What's his name?"
"Titch,
and he's being an awful show-off."
Chris held out his hand.
"Okay, Titch. Can I have the bag now, please?"
At once the dolphin came over to him and lifted its head obligingly for the bag to be removed.
"And how was the tunnel?" Chris asked casually.
Midge made a face.
"Pretty scary."
Then she laughed.
"But it was worth it all the same."
"That's good, then. Coming through there must have taken a lot of guts, believe me, especially when—" He paused, deciding not to say the rest.
"When I'm only a girl, you mean?"
Midge grinned.
"I wasn't going to say that," Chris protested. "And you can leave out the only bit. You're really quite some girl," he added, looking as though he meant it.
Midge didn't answer. She picked up a paddle to stop the boat drifting too close to the rocks.
"You're Chris Manane, aren't you?"
she asked, as casually as she could.
"Yes,"
he seemed surprised.
"And who are you?"
"Claire Beaumont.
Midge, for short."
"I like that. It suits you." But as he said it, Chris was looking steadily at the dolphin. Suddenly it swam to the bow of the boat, turned sideways, and stayed there, holding the boat away from the rocks.
Midge gasped. "I just don't believe this. However did it know what to do?"
Chris laughed. "Maybe I'll keep you guessing about that." Then he asked seriously, "Why did you come, Midge?" Midge hesitated.
"I heard the pipes. It was you playing, wasn't it?"
Chris nodded.
"You like music too, do you?"
"Well, yes, I do. I play piano and a bit of guitar,
But I was reading a book on Greek mythology, you see, and the pan pipes seemed to fit in so perfectly. She shrugged. I just decided to come, that's all. Well, I'm glad you did, Chris hesitated. Midge smiled. Well, I'd better be getting back before that tide turns, she said, reaching for the starter button.
No, don't go. Chris's tone was urgent. You can't, Midge. It's too late. The tide'll turn any minute now.
But I've got to get the boat back. Dad'll kill me for taking it.
Don't worry. We'll drive you back by road. We can use our trailer for the boat.
Midge still felt worried, but realized the sense in what Chris suggested. And she didn't want to go, really. Dad would hit the roof when she got home, but she'd just have to take it, that's all.
Well, okay, she said. And thanks, Chris.
But something out in the bay had caught his attention, and Chris stared, frowning. The dolphins are coming in, and something's wrong. Now he looked really concerned.
My God, it's Bonnie! Marnie's baby, she's been hurt!
Midge had turned to see the dolphins swimming towards them in a slow procession, as if protecting the female carrying her baby calf carefully on her head. The baby was making little squeaks of distress while its mother seemed to be comforting it with low crooning sounds. As the dolphins came closer, they could see that the calf was bleeding from quite a deep gash behind its dorsal fin.
"Oh, poor little thing!" cried Midge. "What's happened to it?"
"Did the dolphins meet you coming in?" Chris asked quietly.
"Yes, they did," Midge gasped, realizing. "Oh, God, it was the boat," she wailed. "The propeller must have done it."
She should never have come, she thought miserably. She'd caused enough trouble already, and now this. Her eyes filled with tears as she jabbed at the starter, and the engine responded at once.
"No, Midge, no."
Alarmed, Chris jumped into the water.
"Stop!"
he shouted desperately as he swam strongly towards the boat. But Midge had already thrown the engine into top gear, and the boat roared off towards the tunnel. As she came closer, Midge could see that the water was choppy and moving fast already. But she thought that if she drove into it at top speed, the boat could manage the whirlpools. The worst part would be steering clear of all those rocks. But if she kept her head, she'd get through all right, she told herself. Midge saw the large clump of kelp weed too late, and the boat ploughed on into it. When the engine suddenly cut out, Midge knew that what she'd feared most had happened. The thick kelp was caught up in the propeller, and in this water there was no way she could free it. Without speed, the boat was helpless. There was nothing she could do now but hang on and steer it as best she could, and hope the outgoing tide would carry her through. She had just managed to avoid one wicked-looking rock when the boat bumped hard up against another. There was a sickening crunch, and Midge was thrown off the seat by the impact. She scrambled up and made a grab at the tiller, but another jolt sent her completely off balance and she toppled overboard. Trying to swim proved hopeless. Choppy waves kept splashing over her head, and, in seconds, she was fighting for breath and gulping great mouthfuls of seawater. Midge knew then that she wasn't going to make it. Suddenly, she felt herself being lifted up and propelled forward at what seemed an incredible speed.
I can't believe this, she thought. What's happening?
As she put her hand down and felt something cool and slippery beneath her, Midge realized that she was being carried by a dolphin, and she knew it was Titch. On the rocks around the point into Outer Bay, Chris waited for them. He knew that Titch was bringing Midge, and that she was not hurt. As soon as Midge went off in the boat, Titch had followed. Sensing the danger, he hadn't waited to be asked, and he guessed where Chris would be waiting. From where he stood, Chris could see that the boat was still afloat and drifting with the current towards the outer entrance. He hoped someone would see it before it got there, otherwise poor Midge would be in more serious trouble than ever. There was a possibility, of course, that it might be washed up somewhere near the entrance. Midge had been mad to go off like that, but he wasn't going to reproach her. He knew why she had. It was then that he spotted Midge's blue top and grinned in relief. "Can you walk all right, Midge?" Chris asked as he helped her to her feet.
"Yes, I think so,"
she answered with a shaky laugh, as she looked around at Titch, who was splashing about with his flippers and chattering happily. "But first I've got to say thank you to a very special dolphin." "Come here, Titch," she called, and the dolphin swam to her at once, sliding his body up onto a smooth ledge of rock, as if he knew she wanted to touch him. Midge squatted down beside him and began to stroke him. "Titch, you've proved yourself a wonderful friend. Thank you for saving me, and I'll be your friend forever." Then she bent and kissed him. It was only then that she noticed the long tear in her shorts and that her strawberry birthmark was showing. Quickly, she dragged her wet panties down over the mark. Then, flushed with embarrassment, looked up. Chris must have noticed, even though he had turned away to watch Titch join the other dolphins now grouped close offshore. Midge decided she had to know. "You saw it, didn't you?" she asked quietly. Chris turned to look at her. "Yes. But it's nothing to be embarrassed about, Midge. My mother was Greek, and she believed that anyone with a birthmark had been touched by the gods, so it's really a lucky sign." "I bet you wouldn't think that, though. Not if you had one yourself." Chris grinned down at her. "You've lost your bet then, Midge. Look." Turning his back, he showed her a strawberry birthmark about 6 centimeters long, just above his buttocks. "There you are," he spun around with a grin. "So we were both born lucky, wouldn't you say?" "Well," Midge shrugged and then agreed. "Okay, you win. I believe you." "Good," Chris said cheerfully, holding out his hand. "Come on, let's go then. We've got a bit of a climb ahead, I'm afraid, but we'll take it in easy stages." Midge wondered where Chris could be heading for as he helped her up the steep cliff face. To get around the point and into the other bay from there seemed impossible. Then she saw the small opening halfway up. It had been invisible from below. "Are we going in there?" she asked. "Where does it lead to, Chris?" Chris grinned back. "Home," he said. Once through the opening, the cave roof was so low for a few meters that they had to crawl. Then the passage became a wide crevasse that led upwards through the cliff itself. Midge could see that light was coming from a hole higher up. That was where they were heading, Chris told her. Midge found it hard going in places. She still felt shaky, and she was glad of Chris's steadying hand and calm, assuring voice, suggesting how best to negotiate the difficult spots. As Chris helped her up through the hole, Midge was surprised to see that they were only about 100 meters from the house. "Well, thank goodness that's over," she puffed, collapsing in a heap. "I've had it." "I'll bet," Chris agreed as he sat beside her, then grinned. "You've got guts, though, Midge." Suddenly Midge sat up. "Oh, hell, the boat! I'll have to ring Dad right away." Chris got up. "No, stay there. I'll do it. You're in no fit state to do anything right now. What's your number?" "Mum and Dad will still be at the Wilsons, unless someone's seen the boat." Midge looked horrified. "Oh, no!" "Better give me both numbers, then," Chris said calmly. "Don't worry, Midge. I'll tell them you're okay. That's the main thing, and that we'll be driving you home." Midge screwed up her face. "Knowing Dad, he'll insist on coming to get me himself." The barbecue pool party at the Wilsons was in full swing. Rock music blared from loudspeakers in the patio roof, and tantalizing food aromas mingled with the blue haze that hovered about the expensive-looking barbecue beneath. Everyone was laughing and talking as they ate. The Outer Bay mob was standing in groups or sitting around the pool. Their parents were seated at tables under bright sun umbrellas, shouting to be heard above the blaring music. Jeff Beaumont, a fresh drink in his hand, walked to the deck railing. Sipping his drink, he scanned the rocky beach below, hoping to see Midge, but there was no sign of her. She should have come, her father thought. It wasn't that she didn't get on with the others. They all liked Midge. Everyone did. But she was a funny kid, a bit of a loner maybe, and different somehow. It was then that he saw a boat out on the bay and stared in shock. It was their boat, all right, adrift and heading straight for the outer channel. But how the hell could it have got away from the jetty, he wondered. He'd tied it up himself after they'd skied that morning. Surely Midge would have noticed it out there, though.
unless... Oh, my God, he muttered. What if she'd taken the boat out? They wouldn't have heard it, with that blasted music blaring at full bore and all the racket going on. He gripped the rail. Now, don't panic, he told himself. That couldn't have happened. Midge knows she's not allowed to take the boat out alone. It's just got away somehow. He half-emptied his glass, reassuring himself. But he'd have to get that boat in a hurry, all the same, before the tide swept it out through the entrance and into the open sea. "Hey, George!" he called, and one of the men looked up. "Our boat's come adrift. It's heading for the entrance. Is it okay if I take yours? I'll have to go and get it." "Sure, Jeff, go ahead," George laughed. "You'd want to tie the damn thing up a bit better, you know." Midge, her slight figure almost lost in a shirt and shorts belonging to Chris, sat next to him on the comfortable big couch in the living room at Cliffhurst. Dr. Manane was explaining to Midge that the dolphin group had not come in procession like that in order to accuse her. It was just their way of being very caring and protective when one of the group was sick or in trouble. They just wanted Chris to know about Bonnie because of the strong bond there was between them and Chris. Then he went on to explain to Midge why it was neither necessary nor advisable to stitch up the baby dolphin's wound, even though to her it might have looked quite extensive. "Wounds like that heal extremely quickly in marine mammals, so are better left alone," he said. Then he smiled kindly at her. "Don't worry, Midge. Bonnie will be quite all right in a few days."
"Well, thank goodness for that," said Midge. "I felt terrible about the way it happened."
"It wasn't your fault, Midge," Chris assured her. "Bonnie's too young to dodge things the way her elders do. She just wasn't quick enough to get out of the way, that's all."
They all looked up as Rita came in with three steaming mugs of coffee on a tray and a large plate of delicious-looking cakes. Her dark eyes flicked away from the visitor as she offered coffee to Dr. Manane.
"I made the cakes specially for you, Doctor."
But the doctor merely nodded as he took a cake with a polite thank you. With a pout of disappointment, Rita came over to Midge.
"I think you are very lucky, no?" she said. "Your father will soon come to take you home. You take sugar?"
She prattled on as Midge shook her head.
"You very pretty girl. Chris, he lucky too. He nice boy, no?"
She gave Midge a knowing smile. Chris could see that Midge was embarrassed and came to the rescue.
"Rita, you talk too much. And I'll have a special cake, thank you," he said, reaching for one.
"You get my abalone, Chris?"
she asked, handing him his mug. Then, as his hand stopped in midair,
"Maybe you forgot, huh?"
"No, they're down below," he told her. "I'll get them later."
He'd dropped the bag when Midge had raced away in the boat, but he knew where it was.
"I'm glad Dad got the boat all right," Midge said. She turned to Chris. "Mum said they were both coming, did she?"
Chris grinned. "Yes, she was quite insistent on that. Wouldn't hear of us driving you back, either." Midge was relieved that there were no recriminations when her parents arrived, and, as nothing was said about the tunnel, she knew Chris must have left that part out, and was grateful to him for it.
"Now you're sure she's all right, Doctor?" Jeff Beaumont asked anxiously, as he and Hilary followed Dr. Manane out of the room.
"Shouldn't she have a sedative or something?" Hilary added, looking back at Midge.
"No," Dr. Manane shook his head. "A good long sleep is all she needs. Perhaps a couple of aspirin might help, if she's still uptight."
As the others went out, Midge and Chris looked at each other. It was time to say goodbye, and both were sorry.
"Can I come again, Chris?" Midge asked quietly. Chris took her hand.
"I was hoping you'd want to," he replied with a shy half-smile.
"What about the day after tomorrow? If you feel up to it, that is. The same place where Titch brought you? About 2 o'clock?"
"All right," Midge looked pleased.
"I'll sailboard over, or borrow someone's scooter boat."
Chris nodded.
"Fine. And thanks for not mentioning about the way we came back, Midge. Dad and I are the only ones who know about it, apart from you now. So you won't mention it to anyone, will you? They all think Titch must have brought you out on the Tunnel Bay side, so let's leave it at that, eh?"
"Okay, Chris," Midge grinned up at him. "Keeping it a secret will be rather fun, anyhow." In one of a line of elegant terraced flats facing Green Park in London's West End, Alan Munnane sat slumped over the paper-littered desk in his den, his head in his hands. A pen lay on the sheet of writing paper in front of him. Under the beautifully embossed address he had written the date, then the words, "Dear Paul," but he'd not been able to go on with the letter. How was he going to tell his brother that the precious nest egg he'd asked him to invest had all gone? The news of the biggest share market crash for years had been broadcast only a few hours ago and had stunned the world. It still amazed Alan that he'd failed to see the crash coming, but it seemed nobody had. He himself had lost a good many of his own investments, but he still owned some sound real estate in outer London and the gold bars he'd bought up as a safeguard, so he hadn't been all that badly hit. However, he knew that the crash would have a disastrous effect on his brother's future. As far as he knew, that money had been almost all the capital Paul possessed. He'd pinned his faith in his brother's ability as a surefire investor, and now Alan felt he had let him down. Paul would by now have heard news of the crash in Australia, but would still be unaware of how deeply he was involved. Alan screwed his eyes shut, hating the very thought of what he had to do. But there was no way out this time. He must not only tell his brother, but bear the blame as well. Despairingly, his fingers clenched tight into his thick sandy hair. "I'm sorry, little brother," he murmured. "So goddamned sorry." With a long sigh, Alan sat up, squared his shoulders, picked up the pen, and began to write. The tall, thin man and his sturdy companion, both in casual sports clothes, could have been tourists as they stood on a rise overlooking the Newcastle Inner Harbour and the wharves lining it. Each using powerful binoculars, the men appeared to be scanning everything that moved in the busy basin waters between the tall silo buildings rising high on one side and the dockyards jutting out into the harbour from the other. But it was one particular part of the dockyards which interested them most. Focusing his binoculars once again on the place of special interest, Gerard Feldman's thin lips spread into a smile as he watched a man in a blue uniform join another, standing guard outside heavy iron gates. Behind the tall cyclone fence, a grey ship rose high on the slipway. From here, it looked like some kind of cargo vessel, of medium size, yet sleeker than usual and more streamlined. "Ah, yes," Feldman said quietly. "You notice, Stefan, that they have now doubled the security guard." "Of course," Stefan Brunston replied laconically. "Which means that she is somewhere near completion." "Yes, I think she should soon be ready to take on her special cargo," Feldman grinned. "But that will take some weeks," Alex says, "so there will be time enough." "See," Stefan pointed excitedly. "The target mark is already painted near her bow. We are in luck, Gerard." "Don't point, you fool," Gerard almost spat the words. "Do you want everyone to know what we are looking at? Someone could be watching us." Feldman was focusing again on the ship as he spoke, both thumbs pressing up against the bulky center part of his binoculars. Suddenly, a tiny camera shot down. Feldman quickly adjusted the telescopic lens, and then there were several clicks before the camera was pressed back out of sight. "Come, back to the car," Feldman commanded irritably as he turned away, stuffing the binoculars into his pocket. "No, perhaps it is best if I go first. You stay back as if something interests you at the ferry terminal, then follow. Maybe no one will suspect us if we behave like tourists." "You got some shots of the target mark then, did you, Gerard?" Stefan asked anxiously, as he climbed into the car, parked halfway up a short, steep street. "Of course," was Feldman's terse reply. "It was a good thing that I noticed it then," Stefan said a little smugly. But Feldman would not let him score a point. "You think I have not eyes, too?" he asked scornfully. "And who took the photos while you were so busy pointing? Those photos will be the most important to our plans yet." Resenting the patronizing tone, Stefan glared ahead but said nothing. Gerard was making too much of a habit of speaking to him this way, he thought angrily, and had better be careful. He, Stefan, would not take much more of it. But he seemed to have forgotten the incident, as the two discussed quite amicably their coming visit to Dr. Paul Manane, as they sped north along the highway in their hired car. Alone in the car, which could not have been bugged, they felt it safe to ignore Alex's instruction to speak English at all times. "You present the apple cider and the other gifts, Stefan," Gerard said. "You have a better way with people than I, and your English is better than mine." "Oh, very well, then," Stefan sounded gratified at the unexpected compliment. "I will explain that neither of us drinks alcohol, and ask that the cider be chilled for the dinner, right?" "Yes. If Dr. Monane is not well, he will prefer a non-alcohol drink like our cider," Gerard laughed. "I doubt if he will need much persuasion, eh?" Stefan chuckled. "I will arrange it so that I sit on the other side of the table and you next to the good doctor. Then, while I distract everyone by telling jokes, you can reach across and squeeze the contents of the plastic phial in your hand into the doctor's glass." Stefan chuckled again. "It will be easy. You've practiced it enough to deceive even me now." Gerard allowed the car to take a bend a little too fast and had to jab on the brakes to avoid ramming the old cattle truck trundling along in front of them. Stefan gasped, stiffening in his seat apprehensively, but said nothing. "We will leave early for our motel," Gerard said calmly as he moved the car out quickly to pass the truck. "We'll insist that the good doctor should have his rest. He will feel nothing for 6 hours, and the pain should be quite mild at first." Stefan, having recovered, went on. "Then I will telephone early the following morning, as arranged, to give our decision," he said complacently. "Be sure to say we agree to buy at once, Stefan. And don't be put off, even if the doctor says he is too ill to sign the papers that day."
"Of course, I'm not stupid."
"I will show great concern if the doctor says he is not well, and I'll say we don't wish to trouble him, but would like to see the studio cave once more."
"And suggest that the boy or Carl take us down to the cave to save him the trouble."
"Good point," Stefan nodded approvingly. "We want to appear as considerate and cooperative as possible."
"But be careful, Stefan," Gerard insisted. "Don't overdo it or sound in too much of a hurry to buy."
"Of course I won't," Stefan assured him. "Just leave it to me. The sale papers will be signed before the doctor leaves for the hospital. By then he'll be so ill that his wish to sell at once will be greater even than before."
"Aha," Gerard agreed. "Then, after we have all signed the papers and you have handed the doctor our cheque for the £75,000 deposit, he'll feel very relieved that at least his financial worries are over."
"Of course," Stefan chuckled and added mockingly, "it is very important for the good doctor not to worry, and for him to be happy about having sold to such friendly buyers, and for such good price, eh, Gerard?" Stefan lifted his head and roared with laughter. But Gerard merely nodded and smiled his thin, wintry smile as he twisted the wheel, accelerating to pass a big transport truck.
"Well, Chris, they seem keen to buy, all right." In the sitting room at Cliffhurst, Paul Manane relaxed back into his favourite chair as the sound of their guest's departing car faded into the night. He sounded tired, but relieved. Chris still stood looking thoughtfully out of the sliding glass doors opening onto the front veranda, and did not answer at once. He looked worried as he turned to face his father.
"Dad, there's something phony about those two. I can feel it. I don't like either of them, particularly Feldman. He gives me the creeps. And Brunston, who did all the talking, laughs too much. And all those teeth."
His father sighed.
"Chris,
Are you sure you're not letting your own feelings about having to sell here interfere with your judgment? They seemed harmless enough to me. An MMRI is known worldwide. Chris came over to the couch and threw himself down.
Sorry, Dad. Maybe I am being a bit too anti. And I suppose they're all right.
He looked up. If they say yes tomorrow morning, will you clinch the deal with them?
Paul Munane smiled a tired smile. I think I'd be an idiot not to, don't you? It's the best price I'm ever likely to get, Chris. His tone was almost apologetic. I expected them to knock my price back by at least 10,000, and that's about its true market value.
Yes, and that's another strange thing, Chris replied. You'd almost think they'd made up their minds to buy at any price. And did you notice how Carl and Rita fell all over the two of them when they first arrived? Like long-lost friends. But I heard Feldman putting Rita back in her place pretty smartly.
Did you?
His father smiled.
Yes, and I've heard you do the same thing yourself, Chris.
Only when she goes overboard, Chris protested.
Well, maybe Rita was overdoing it a bit again today, that's all. Anyway, both Carl and Rita worked at that same tourist resort where Alan first met Feldman and Brunston, remember? And it was they who recommended them to Alan.
Yes, I'd forgotten that, Chris looked thoughtful. And from their accents, I wouldn't be surprised if they all came from the same country, whatever that is, Chris added.
Could you pick the accent, Dad?
Both looked around as Rita came in, smiling with a glass full of a cloudy liquid on a small drinks tray, which she brought across to Dr. Munane.
Your lemon and barley water, Doctor?
She looked up at the clock on the mantelpiece.
And I am not late this time, no? I not forget tonight.
She smiled down at him. Paul Munane took the glass. Thank you, Rita.
Your meal was superb tonight, Rita, he smiled appreciatively. The abalone dish especially. Our visitors were most impressed.
Delighted at his praise, Rita's big dark eyes flashed, her face lighting up with pleasure.
Thank you, Doctor. You are very kind.
Then, with a grimace,
but to drink only cider with my dinner, she wrinkled her nose. Pooh, that was not good, and Carl, he not understand it.
Well, it seems that our visitors don't drink alcohol, Rita, and as they were kind enough to bring a whole case of very good apple cider, the doctor shrugged. We didn't have much choice, I'm afraid.
But Carl, he think that very strange. He say he serve them lot and lot of vodka, bourbon too, when they stay at Papinello Resort. Every night they pretty drunk, he say.
Chris, leafing through a magazine, had lifted his eyebrows in surprise at this revelation. Now he turned to his father.
There you are, Dad, and I still think those two are phonies.
Rita looked puzzled.
Phonies, Chris?
The doctor drained his glass and returned it to the tray. The word is a bit hard to explain, Rita. Chris has taken a dislike to them, that's all. He passed one hand wearily over his forehead.
Well, I think I'll turn in. Got a bit of a headache.
He eased himself out of his chair and staggered a little as he stood up. Has Carl got everything shut down safely below, Rita? He asked in a tired voice.
Carl, he down there doing that now, Doctor. Rita looked concerned. Please, you take something for pain this time, she pleaded as Paul Munane started for the door. It make you sleep better, too, she added hopefully.
Go on, Dad, Chris encouraged from the couch. It's time you stopped being so pig-headed about taking pills.
Paul Munane's tone was unusually irritable.
Oh, for God's sake, get off my back, the two of you. I'm all right, I tell you. A good night's rest is all I need.
He turned at the door.
Well, good night, he said, and left.
Good night, Dad.
Good night, Doctor,
chorused Chris and Rita, then looked at each other. Rita opened her mouth to speak, but Chris got in first.
Well, Rita, you and Carl don't seem too worried about us selling up here, he said. Both got other jobs lined up, have you?
Lined up? What that mean?
Rita looked puzzled.
Have you both found work somewhere else after we've gone? Chris explained. Rita beamed happily.
No, we stay here. Mr. Bronston, he says so to Carl.
Then her smile faded.
But it will be sad for me when you and your father not here no more, Chris.
Rita hesitated, as though she felt she had said too much.
Good night, Chris,
she murmured, and hurried from the room.
So it looks as if I was right, Chris thought, frowning. Feldman and Brunston are going to buy Cliffhurst. The two of them, and the Rimmers, have got it all worked out. There's something fishy behind all this selling business. I wish to God I could find out what, and stop it before it's too late. But there's nothing I can put a finger on. Oh, hell! Chris clenched his fists, thumping his knees in desperation.
Paul Manane heard the thundering rattle of falling rocks above him, and instinctively covered his head with his arms. And suddenly the rocks were upon him, beating down relentlessly until he was bent almost double with the stinging force of their impact on his arms and shoulders. Then he felt a heavy, sickening thud in the small of his back, and gasped as the fiery pain spread upwards through his body, growing unbearably until there came a blackness. Paul opened his eyes to the semi-darkness of his bedroom and the sound of sleepy bird calls, and, once again, he felt the momentary relief of knowing it had been only a dream, the same dream in which he had relived that same terror many times since it actually happened, 7 years ago on the Greek island of Hydra. But, as always, the pain was still there when he woke, although much worse this time. He was burning up with a high fever, too, and so nauseated that he had to swallow hard to fight down the bitter bile that rose in his throat. He felt his face, and, as he suspected, the hot, wet skin was stretched tight as a drum. His hands were puffed up, and his feet, too, by the feel of them. With a sinking heart, Paul realized that this was much more than a mild infection that he could deal with as he had before. This time he'd have to face the fact that his wretched kidneys, badly ruptured in that rockfall years ago, had finally packed up. There had been warning signs for many months now. As he turned his head to look at the bedside clock, which read 5:30, his eyes rested on the lovely, smiling face in the framed photograph beside it. My Marita! Paul's hand reached out to touch her. I still miss you terribly, darling. He spoke to her silently, as he often did. You know, you never looked lovelier than on the day I took that photo, and so happy about the new baby coming that you just glowed somehow. I kissed your nose, told you to stay put, and rushed inside to get the camera, remember? I wanted to capture you just as you looked then. Paul smiled at her now. I'm so glad I did. Paul grimaced as another bad spasm of pain gripped him, and he held his breath until it passed, then went on talking silently. We'd been talking about how we wanted our new baby born underwater in the same warm rock pool as Chris was. That was wonderful, wasn't it, Marita? And wasn't it just incredible how those two female dolphins helped us, taking our baby from me so gently and holding him there in the water while I severed the cord? And you just lay there smiling and so trusting, darling. I'm sure I wouldn't have been if I hadn't seen the dolphins do it before. But for us there was no second time, was there? For a few seconds Paul looked away. Even now it still hurt to remember how suddenly Marita had gone. One morning she was reading to the children in the little school at Hydra when she just went to sleep and didn't wake up, as the children told him afterwards. And they'd scoured the island for great armfuls of wild flowers to put on her grave. They too, like everyone else, had loved her. Paul gasped as more waves of pain and nausea gripped him and gradually passed. He could hear Rita moving about in the kitchen now. Their days started early at Cliffhurst. Soon Rita would bring his early morning cup of tea. The sooner the better, he thought. Sometimes Chris came in to join him, and Paul hoped he would today. If this pain grew any worse, he would have to go into hospital, and without too much delay. He'd call for an ambulance. Yes, that would be better all round, he thought, as Chris would want to come too, and he'd like that himself. but there were certain papers that must not be left here. He'd have to take them with him. Chris would see to it, and could be trusted to say nothing. What a comfort the boy was! He wondered if Chris knew that. He must be sure to tell him. Poor Chris, he thought. This happening on top of everything else will be pretty rough on him. He turned to look at Marita. But he'll cope, Marita. He's strong, like his mother. And you'll be coming with us too, you know. I'd never leave you behind. Not with those two here, even for a few hours. Chris doesn't like them. Can't say I do either, come to think of it. Paul wondered if Chris could be right about Feldman and Brunston not being what they seemed. But he soon dismissed the thought. Their enthusiasm and amazement on seeing the dolphins' reactions in the studio cave yesterday was quite genuine. He was certain of that. And after all, they were both highly qualified and experienced scientists, whose interests seemed to run almost parallel with his own as far as dolphins were concerned. Their praise of what he had accomplished so far was genuine enough, too. No doubt MMRI did similar research. No, Paul thought. Chris was merely overreacting to his strong reluctance to leave Cliffhurst, and that was quite understandable. Didn't he feel the same way himself? It was damned hard to give up the project at this stage. His only consolation had to be that he intended to write a book about his family of wild dolphins here at Tunnel Bay. But he'd changed the venue, of course. He wouldn't want people coming here just to gawp at them. The book would make good reading, and his story would amaze the world. So few people knew how incredibly capable, intelligent, and gentle these noble sea creatures really were. Stefan R. Brunston. Stefan signed his name with the usual flourish underneath the carefully lettered signature of Gerard J. Feldman on the contract of sale form in front of him. Then, wordlessly, the paper was passed to the vendor, Dr. Paul Manane, who sat hunched over at the head of the dining table, a rug over his knees. He too signed his name in silence, then leaned back wearily in his chair. Chris, sitting next to him, glanced unhappily at his father. He looked so ill now, and the pain must be really bad for him to let Brunston do all the talking and hardly say a word himself. That was so unlike him. What alarmed Chris most was that his father seemed beyond caring about anything at all now. Surely he didn't think he was going to die. Chris shut his eyes. Oh, God! Was this why he'd wanted the sale to go through today? To get it over with? The pieces began to fit together. Ever since Brunston's phone call this morning, he had tried to persuade his father not to sign everything up in such a hurry, especially when he felt so ill, but he had done no good. And then, soon after they'd sat down at the table, when Brunston had offered his father a check for the full price instead of a deposit, he'd demurred once again. But his father would not be put off, and agreed to accept the check. And now it was all over.
"Thank you, doctor," Stefan Brunston bowed ingratiatingly, beaming his toothy smile, and Chris drew in his breath sharply, clenching his fists as he felt an urge to bash those teeth in. But Brunston appeared not to notice, and beamed again at Paul Manane.
"Now, sir, perhaps it is time for you to sign over the title deeds."
He picked up a transfer of title form from the pile in front of him. "As new owners and walk-in, walk-out sale, is it not right that MMRI hold title also?"
Paul Manane nodded.
"Yes, of course." His tone was non-committal as he fumbled inside his file, produced a long white document folded in half, and handed it over. Chris, feeling sympathy for his father, could do nothing but look on miserably as the title changed hands and Carl was called in to sign as witness to the signatures. It was hard to believe that Cliffhurst and everything in it, apart from their personal possessions, no longer belonged to them. As he looked at the two new owners' smug expressions, Chris's conviction that something was wrong about these men was stronger than ever. In fact, everything about them was beginning to stink like rotten fish. Chris looked up with the others as Rita came in with a loaded tea tray. Her usual smile was missing, he noticed. Her eyes were red, too, as if she'd been crying. Suddenly, he couldn't bear to stay in the room a moment longer, and got up quickly, murmuring that he had to finish packing as he hurried out. An hour later, Paul Manane, barely conscious now, was carried out to the waiting ambulance. Carl followed with two suitcases and then Chris, with a briefcase and three bulging satchels containing his father's precious papers. As the ambulance moved off, Chris looked back at the house and wondered miserably when he would see it again. He saw Carl waving from the steps, his arm around Rita, who was weeping openly now. Suddenly the full impact of leaving this place that he'd grown to love so much, and with his father so critically ill, hit him, and he closed his eyes, trying to squeeze back the stinging tears.
"Race you, Midge!" Bill Lumridge called as his sailboard came level with hers.
Midge turned and shook her head.
"No, Bill, not now," she called back. "Three's a crowd and all that."
She grinned as her board shot ahead. Bill, disappointed, looked after her as she headed towards the opposite side of the bay. She'd made it clear enough that he wasn't wanted. But who was she going with? He glanced around. The others were all either skiing or racing each other on scooter boats, but no one was following Midge. Then the penny dropped. She must be going to meet that Chris Manane. Bill shaded his eyes against the sun, searching the rocky shoreline around the point from the tunnel gap, but there was no sign of anyone. "Oh, well," he shrugged. "She knows what she's doing, I suppose." Midge beached her sailboard on a small strip of sand, and, as she walked towards the flat rocks where Chris was to meet her, she searched the cliff face for the tiny cave entrance halfway up, but couldn't see it. She was a bit early, she knew, so she hadn't been surprised that Chris wasn't there, although that would have been nice, she thought. But it might be fun to surprise him instead. Her thoughts ran on. It would be easier climbing up to the hole in the cliff today. She wasn't tired out. In fact, she felt fitter than ever. She'd go up and wait for Chris inside, where they'd begun their main climb to the top. Midge recognized the rock from where they'd climbed the cliff to the hole, and she'd been right. It was quite easy going. She'd almost reached the hole when she started to giggle and stopped. What if the two of them met halfway in that first part, where they'd had to crawl? That would be a tricky manoeuvre. But by 2:25, it didn't seem to Midge to be such a fun idea after all, to be waiting up there in the half-dark. By then she was shivering with cold and beginning to worry. What had happened to Chris? She was sure he wouldn't have forgotten. It was then that she first heard the rumbling, rattling noise and, unbelievably, what sounded like women, or was it children, screaming in a high-pitched chorus. Alarmed, Midge leaned forward to listen. The screams seemed to come from deep inside the cliff and were accompanied by a continuous rumbling, rattling noise that she couldn't identify. What on earth was happening? Midge didn't hesitate. Well, there's only one way to find out, she thought as she edged herself forward along the narrow ledge, looking for an opening in the almost sheer wall where she could climb down and not up, as they'd done before. She had gone about 4 meters when she found an opening. Although only just wide enough to squeeze through at first, Midge could see that the fissure opened out further down where a narrow ledge sloped fairly steeply to a flat rock a few meters below, and she thought she could manage that all right. "So far, so good," she breathed as she stepped down into the rock. The children's screaming sounded louder now, chorused intermittently through the continuous rumbling, rattling noise. But this time she could hear men's voices too, and what sounded like dolphins' excited squeakings as they splashed about. Now Midge had a fair idea of what she was hearing, but even that didn't seem possible, not away down here, of all places. Well, she would soon know, she thought, as she searched the wet rock walls for another opening. Yes, there was one, but it would be tricky getting to it. She'd have to step across to another ledge higher up, and as far as she could see, there didn't seem to be any handholds in the wall to help her. Midge took a deep breath. "Well, here goes," she muttered as she edged her way forward. With bare feet, she'd have to be extra careful now. Water was seeping through everywhere, making the ledge dangerously slippery. But she managed it, having found several crannies in the wall to cling to. Now she had to bend almost double to pass through a low tunnel curving down to her right. Surprisingly, there was enough light to see by, and, as she rounded a bend, Midge found that she could stand upright again. She was amazed to find that she was now standing in a narrow alcove, high in the wall of an enormous, roughly elongated cave, floodlit so brightly that she had to screw up her eyes against the glare. This must be the studio cave Chris had mentioned, Midge thought. And it was almost like an underground theatre. The stage, at the narrow end, was completely glassed in, both under the water and up to a height of at least 4 meters above it. Behind the glass, a meter or so above the waterline, was the largest television Midge had ever seen, and, as she'd guessed, a video was being screened of a simulated roller coaster ride. And the dolphins were loving it, joining their excited squeaks to the chorus of screams and squeals from the unseen riders, mostly children by the sound of them, as the car plunged, taking the viewer with it, at breathtaking speed down into a seeming abyss and then up again, jerking around a sharp bend in the track, then pausing for a heart-stopping second or two, before racing down and around in a complete circle to level out again, then gradually slow to a stop. The ride was over. Midge began to breathe again. She'd been holding her breath as she watched. It had certainly been exciting. One dolphin, it looked like Titch, suddenly rose high out of the water and did a complete somersault, re-entering with hardly a splash. Another dolphin was turning in quick circles, then diving underwater. Two others were tail-walking and flapping their flippers, as if applauding. Midge watched curiously as one of the smaller dolphins swam up to a large wooden crate with what looked like a paddle painted white jutting out over the water. The dolphin's head rose up, and, as it pressed the paddle down with its beak, a small fish came flying out of the box to be caught deftly, then swallowed with obvious relish. "I just can't believe this," Midge thought. "It's incredible," she grinned to herself. "And I feel just like Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz." It was then that Midge noticed the three men sitting behind the glass, watching the dolphins. On a low table in front of them was a small monitor screen. One of the men she recognized as Carl, whom she'd seen the other day. The tall, thin man and the plump one were both strangers.
"Which dolphin is that?" asked the thin man, pointing. "The one that caught the fish."
Carl smiled.
"Oh, that one is Bobo, a big show-off Bobo. Not so clever as the others, but he's learned how to get his fish," Carl laughed. "But that is only because Bobo is very greedy."
Midge didn't like the way the tall, thin man smiled as he looked meaningfully at the third man.
"That Bobo, Stefan, we must teach him more ways to catch fish, no?"
Who were these men who talked about teaching the dolphin more ways to catch fish, Midge wondered. And where was Dr. Manane? After all, it was he who ran this place. And where was Chris? Now was certainly not the time to ask, either. She couldn't explain how she got here without giving away the secret back way in. Thank goodness she was standing above the lights, so they'd not have seen her. Somehow Midge knew now that Chris wouldn't be coming and that something was wrong. Then why hadn't Chris rung her? Perhaps he had, she thought. But no one would have been home. Her parents had driven down to Newcastle for the day, and she'd taken a sandwich and raced down to join the others on the beach. The best thing to do now was to get home as fast as she could and wait for Chris to ring again. She was quite certain he would. Unless... what if something awful had happened to him and he couldn't? Midge shivered at the thought. Well, she'd ring his number first then, and find out. At least Rita would be there. For the third time, Chris put down the telephone receiver and collected the coins that rattled down the chute. Midge's number was still not answering, which was surprising as it was now lunchtime. He'd remembered his date with Midge when the ambulance was halfway to Newcastle, but there had been no chance to ring her until 11. He would try again later, he thought, as he left the booth and hurried back to the hospital waiting room. His father was unconscious when they arrived at the hospital, and within seconds of being wheeled inside, the trolley was quickly whisked away through the doubled swing doors at the end of the corridor. Worried, and not knowing what to do, Chris put his suitcase down and stood holding the briefcase and satchels. White-coated doctors and nursing staff hurried past him with intent expressions and barely a glance, until a slim, auburn-haired nurse took pity on him and stopped, her face lighting up as she smiled. "You look a bit lost," she said kindly. "Can I help you?" "Yes, please," Chris hesitated. "Well, I'm not sure what happens now. You see, my father, Dr. Manane, has just been admitted. He's very ill, unconscious. We came down by ambulance."
"Oh, I am sorry." The girl's sympathy was genuine. "Who is his doctor?"
Chris half smiled at the question.
"Well, you know doctors. Most of them think they don't need one."
"Fair enough," laughed the girl. "Look, why don't you go and wait in the waiting room? Turn left at the end of the passage, and it's the last door on the right. I'll find out who's looking after your father, and tell them where you are. They'll come and have a word to you as soon as they can." She paused.
"It could be quite a while, though. Dr. Manane, you said?"
"Yes, Dr. Paul Manane."
Chris smiled appreciatively.
"And thanks a lot."
Midge could hear the telephone ringing as she came up the back steps to the house. Having run all the way up from the beach, her legs felt like lead, but now she willed them to run.
"Oh, please don't hang up yet," she was thinking, as she hurried across the new patio to the back door, which she knew wouldn't be locked.
The phone was still ringing as she grabbed the receiver from the kitchen wall phone. After hearing the STD beeps, she tried to speak, but was so short of breath that no words would come.
"Hello?"
The voice at the other end sounded like Chris, but Midge wasn't sure.
"Is that you, Chris?"
she panted.
"Yes,"
he paused.
"Look, are you all right, Midge?"
he asked anxiously.
"I've been running, that's all. Are you okay, though? Where are you?"
"Newcastle. Dad's in hospital, Midge. He's pretty sick."
He sounded worried.
"He's in intensive care."
"Oh, Chris, I'm so sorry."
Midge's voice was warm with sympathy.
"I knew something was wrong when you didn't come."
"I tried to catch you before you left, Midge. Ever since 11 o'clock, but your number hasn't been answering."
"No one's been home. Mum and Dad are in Newcastle, and I've just got back. But what about your father, Chris?"
she asked anxiously.
"What's wrong? He's not..."
Somehow Midge couldn't say the word.
"Dying? No, thank goodness. But it's pretty serious," the doctor said. "It's acute kidney failure. And something else. They don't know what yet. And his blood pressure was way up, too. But he's stable now, they say."
"Well, that's some comfort, anyway." Midge sounded relieved. "But what about you, Chris? Where will you stay?"
"Well, I've found a motel. Only a few streets away from the hospital, actually."
"Oh, that's good, then."
Midge paused, then went on excitedly.
"Chris, I've seen the studio cave. The dolphins were there, and it was fantastic."
"Wow! However did you find your way down there?"
Chris sounded surprised.
"You must have gone in through the back way, did you?"
"Yes," Midge laughed. "I was a bit early, so I thought I'd meet you halfway. Well, I'd just got through that first narrow bit when I heard noises, like kids screaming and a rumbling sound. So I climbed down to find out what on earth was happening, and ended up in a sort of alcove high up in a cave, all lit up. And Chris, when I looked down, I just couldn't believe my eyes."
"Did anyone see you, Midge?"
Chris asked anxiously.
"Who was there?"
"Carl and two other men. And don't worry, no one saw me." "Who were the men, Chris?"
"The new owners of Cliffhurst. They're from MMRI.
Midge could sense the unhappiness in his voice.
"Oh, Chris, no. Cliffhurst sold? And what's MMRI?
"Matro Mammal Research Institute. The contract was signed early this morning. I tried to stop Dad, but he wouldn't listen. I think he thought he was on the way out and wanted the sale over and done with."
"But that's terrible, Chris. What will you do?"
"Goodness knows. That'll be up to Dad," once he's on his feet again. For a moment, Midge said nothing. This news was so devastating that she was almost lost for words. "Oh, Chris," was all she could say. "Midge, will you do something for me?" Chris asked. "Of course I will, if I can. What is it?" "Could you keep an eye on what's happening at Cliffhurst? Midge, I don't trust those two men somehow, and I'd like to know what they're up to."
"Well, now you mention it, I didn't take to either of them myself, especially the tall, skinny one. And yes, of course I'll keep an eye on what's going on. It'll be easy now that I know the back way in."
"Well, promise you'll be very careful, Midge. There are some tricky places in that climb down, as you know, and only go as far as the studio cave. Whatever they plan to do will be done there, and always around high tide, remember. The dolphins know that."
"Okay, I'll be careful. And how often should I go?"
Short beeps sounded at the other end.
"Hang on," Chris muttered. "Got to feed this thing. Oh, blast, I've only got 20 cents left."
Midge heard the clink of a coin, then Chris went on.
"Sorry, Midge, I've run out of change. Can I ring you tomorrow about 7?
"Yes, I'll be home." "It's too bad we missed out on today. I was really looking forward to that."
"So was I. But it couldn't be helped, could it? And I'm terribly sorry about your father, Chris. Let's hope you'll have better news tomorrow."
"Me too." Again the beep sounded.
"Goodbye, Midge." He paused.
"And you really are some girl, you know. I hope..." Then the line went dead. Midge hung up the phone, wishing there had been time to say goodbye. And what was it, he hoped, she wondered. Midge half smiled. She was hoping, too. It was just after 6 o'clock when Alan Munnane parked his hired car outside the hospital. He'd been warned, when he'd asked directions, that he'd be lucky to get a park inside the grounds at this time of night. Leaning back in the driver's seat, Alan shut his eyes for a moment, suddenly feeling desperately tired. After Chris's early morning phone call the day before, it had been one mad rush. He'd been lucky to get a last-minute booking on an almost direct flight to Sydney. Cancelling everything for the next 3 weeks had taken more than an hour of phoning, sandwiched between throwing things into suitcases, and he'd finally caught the plane with only minutes to spare. It had been the same on the connecting flight from Sydney to Newcastle. On the long flight from London, worrying about his brother had kept sleep away. Paul's illness must be much more serious even than Chris had said. Alan knew that Paul would never have sold Cliffhurst, and so quickly, if there was any hope at all of him returning. And, in a way, he felt guilty for having spilled the beans about what was happening with Paul and his dolphins at Cliffhurst to those two chaps, Brunston and Feldman, in the first place. He'd been led on because they had seemed so interested, but he'd had no idea that their organization might be after it themselves. How could he? And Chris hadn't sounded at all happy about them as buyers yesterday. "There's something fishy about them, Uncle," he'd said, but hadn't been able to explain what he meant when asked why he felt that way. "Well, let's hope young Chris is mistaken," Alan thought, as he locked the car door. "After all, he'd probably feel much the same about anyone buying Cliffhurst, because he loves the place so much, and hates having to leave it." "Hello there! How's your father?" The nurse's cheerful voice cut into Chris's thoughts as he approached the hospital lift. A walk to the beach had brought a sharp nostalgia for Cliffhurst, and he'd been thinking of the dolphins. He missed them already, particularly Titch. Chris smiled, remembering how kind this nurse had been when his father had been rushed away on arrival. "Oh, he's holding his own, they say, but he's still pretty sick." "Well, he's in good hands. Dr. Fenton is our top man here," she smiled. "He's like a bulldog. Never lets go once he's got his teeth into a patient." Chris laughed.
"Good. I'm glad he doesn't give up easily. Neither do we. And he did come to the waiting room as you said he would. He couldn't tell me much then, but I really liked him."
The nurse nodded, then gave him a friendly grin.
"Look, I don't mean to pry or anything. My name's Margaret Sinclair, by the way. But you still look a bit lost. Have you got friends or family to stay with? Chris shook his head. No, but Dad's brother Alan is flying over from London. He'll arrive tomorrow sometime, he grinned. And I'm Chris Munane. Hello, Chris, Margaret smiled, putting out her hand. Where are you staying, then? She asked, as they shook hands. At a motel at the moment. It's okay, and quite handy to the hospital, too. But I'll have to find somewhere more permanent. For a few months, anyway, until we find a house or something. You see, we've just sold our place, and... Chris gave a wry grin. We're a couple of outcasts right now. Oh, poor you, Margaret said sympathetically. There's only you and your father, then. Chris grinned. Yep. For a moment, Margaret said nothing. She was obviously working out something in her mind. Then her eyes twinkled. Well, Chris, what would you say if I told you I know of half a very nice terrace house? Smiling, she ticked the rest of its features off on her fingers. It's the ground floor, fully furnished, only 5 minutes' walk from here, and available right now for 3 months. Chris, who had been staring at Margaret in open-mouthed astonishment, suddenly grinned. Well, first I'd say that it sounds too good to be true, and second, lead me to it. The two were too busy talking to notice the smartly dressed man with sandy hair, who hurried past them and into the waiting lift. Thank you, Alan Munane nodded politely to the nurse, who had held the lift door open for him. Then he glanced through the letters he'd just been given at the inquiry desk. All were typewritten and addressed to Dr. Paul Munane, then readdressed in a large, rather flowery script. With a shrug, Alan put the letters in his pocket. He'd deal with them later, after he'd seen Paul. Alan was worried. Paul must still be critically ill, he thought. That woman at the desk had asked him to use his own discretion about the urgency of the letters, and she obviously wasn't going to let anyone but family in to see him, either. As the lift door closed silently behind him when he got out, Alan looked about, feeling like some unwanted alien. Ever since he could remember, hospitals had always had this intimidating effect, even worse than the dentist's. There was no one about to give him directions, so he began looking for Paul's room number. Locating this proved easy, it being only a few rooms down the corridor. But the door was closed. Should he just barge in, he wondered. He was looking around, deciding who, somewhere along all this pristine, quiet efficiency, he should ask, when the door opened, and a large white-coated man with bristling grey hair and half-glasses almost falling off the end of his splendid nose came out, followed by a tall, efficient-looking sister carrying a medical tray. "I'll be at the desk if you want me, doctor," she said respectfully as she walked away. The doctor nodded, pushing up his glasses as he looked steadily at Alan. "You must be the brother, Alan, isn't it?" He put out a large, fine-boned hand. "Fenton's my name. I'm looking after him," he added, smiling warmly as they shook hands. "How is he, doctor?" Alan asked anxiously. "Improving slowly," Dr. Fenton spoke quietly as he moved away, gesturing for Alan to follow. "But he's still a very sick man." Alan looked alarmed. "He'll pull through this, though, won't he, doctor?" "We have every reason to hope so," he frowned. "Our main concern at the moment is to identify what it is that has caused such a rapid deterioration of his condition and rectify the trouble. You see, his kidneys are barely functioning, I'm afraid. So we must build up his strength for a kidney transplant." The doctor paused, noting Alan's alarm. "The success rate these days is very high, you know, and the patient can lead an almost normal life afterwards."
"Uncle Alan!"
Both men looked around as Chris, his face beaming, hurried towards them.
"You're here! Boy, am I glad to see you!" he went on excitedly as he pumped his uncle's hand. "When did you get here? Have you seen Dad?"
He gave Dr. Fenton a rueful grin.
"Hello, Doctor. Sorry I butted in like that. Got a bit carried away seeing Uncle here already. I didn't expect him until tomorrow."
The doctor nodded.
"Quite understandable, Chris." He looked at his watch. "Well, I must go."
He shook Alan's hand.
"We'll talk again, Alan. You can call me if you're worried about your brother.
I've just given him a sedative, so he'll be a bit drowsy right now. Don't stay too long, will you? Come in again tomorrow. Goodbye.
He nodded to them both and strode off down the corridor. Paul was already asleep when Chris and his uncle entered the room quietly, and, as Alan stood at the foot of his brother's bed, he was shocked to see how ill Paul looked. The sight of so much equipment around him, the tubes taped to his arms, and the constant high beeping of the monitoring machine, filled Alan with dread. Without a word, he turned away and hurried from the room. As they drove to the motel, Chris, knowing how his uncle felt, tried to cheer him up with the story of the prospective flat to let.
"It belongs to Margaret's parents, you see. They flew to London last week. Her grandmother's had a stroke, and they told Margaret that if she found someone suitable, she could let it for the 3 months they'll be away."
Alan managed a tight grin.
"And you're the someone suitable, eh? Well, the place certainly sounds okay, Chris. When do you get to look it over?" "Tonight, at 8 o'clock. We'll just have time to grab a quick meal at the motel, and then walk over together. It's only in the next street."
Alan laughed.
"Oh, come on. You don't need an elderly uncle tagging along." "Hell, it's not like that," Chris protested. "Margaret's at least 25. Besides, I'd like you to meet her. She's a really nice person."
Later that night, as the three sat drinking coffee in the tastefully furnished sitting room of the Tyrrell Street house, Alan could not but agree. Margaret's gentle voice, warm smile, and bubbling sense of humour he found very appealing. Her burnished copper hair, freed from the stiff nurse's cap, curled softly around her face, and the simple elegance of the blue dress she wore flattered her slim figure. Alan and Chris had already decided that the large flat, with its attractive modernized kitchen, alcoved dining room, two bedrooms, a study and sunroom at the rear, would suit them perfectly.
"Just give me a few days to clear cupboard space for you," Margaret laughed. "Mother and Dad rushed off so quickly that there wasn't time for that. Then you can move straight in. Will a week from today be all right?" "Well, I was right, wasn't I, Uncle?" Chris asked teasingly as the two walked back to their motel. "Margaret is a really nice person. You thought so too, I could tell."
Alan laughed.
"You wouldn't be trying on a bit of matchmaking, would you, Chris?"
"Of course not," Chris replied innocently, but the denial wasn't too convincing. Later, in Alan's room, the two discussed plans for collecting the personal belongings still at Cliffhurst.
"How much stuff is there, Chris?" "Oh, only a small truckload, I should think, Uncle. We could hire one easily enough, couldn't we?"
Alan had taken off his jacket, and as he threw it on the bed, he noticed the bundle of letters protruding from one of the pockets.
"Here, you'd better take charge of these, Chris," he said, retrieving the letters. "The hospital didn't want to bother your father with them unless they were urgent."
As his uncle handed him the small bundle, Chris noticed the flowery script on the envelopes and frowned.
"Who redirected these, I wonder? It's not Carl's writing, or Rita's either. But I've seen it before, and quite a few times, too. I'd know that fancy script anywhere."
"Well, it must be either Feldman or Brunston, then."
"Brunston, probably," Alan laughed. "That sort of writing is more his style, I would think."
"But how could..." Chris paused. Suddenly he remembered a fat business envelope, and the addressee's name was Carl Rimmer. Chris exclaimed, looking up at his uncle.
"Brunston has been writing to Carl at Cliffhurst," he added suspiciously.
"Why? What was he up to?"
"Oh, come on," Alan scoffed. "Why not? Feldman and Brunston knew Carl, remember? And if they were interested in the place and wanted to know more about it, isn't it likely that they'd write to Carl rather than your father?"
"Maybe, but all the letters were thick ones, Uncle. They must have had papers of some sort inside."
Alan laughed indulgently.
"Probably news cuttings. They all come from the same country, you know. So isn't it natural that Carl and Rita would be interested in what was going on at home?"
"You think I've got it in for those two, just because they've bought Cliffhurst, don't you, Uncle?"
"Well, maybe that has got something to do with it, Chris," Alan said wearily.
Aren't you overreacting just a bit? Chris got up. No, Uncle Alan, I'm not. Anyway, you must be just about dead on your feet, so I'll go and let you get some sleep. At the door he turned and grinned. And I'm really glad you're here. Sleep well, he added, and closed the door behind him. Midge sat down thankfully on the shelf of rock near the top of the cliff and slipped off her knapsack. The day promised to be a scorcher, and it had been a steep climb. Every morning for 5 days now, she'd come up to this spot. Being shielded by shrubs, it was a perfect vantage point, with a clear view over all of Tunnel Bay and Cliffhurst. And with binoculars, she could see what was going on at the house itself. She hadn't visited the studio cave since Chris had first rung her from Newcastle. The high tide times had either been too early in the morning or too late at night, but she planned to go the next morning at 9 o'clock. So far, she'd managed to convince Bill Lumridge and the others that she'd taken up rock climbing and preferred to do it alone. Midge took her binoculars from the knapsack and trained them on Cliffhurst. The blue panel van that had arrived 3 days ago was still parked in the same place, but the second ladder on top had gone, she noticed. No one seemed to be about, and there wasn't a sound. Midge was disappointed. She'd expected at least some activity and maybe noises, like welding or something, after what she'd seen 3 mornings ago. A ute had arrived about 10 o'clock with a load of what looked like sheets of metal about 2 meters long. Whatever it was must have been quite heavy, as it took 2 men to carry each sheet. But the odd thing was that the tall, skinny man, who must have been Gerard Feldman by Chris's description, directed the men to take the sheets up the steps and in through the front door. What on earth were they going to do with them, Midge wondered. Then, an hour later, a big truck had come with a load of large crates and boxes, and these two were taken inside by the 2 men.
"Hey! You go away! Get out of there!"
Midge jumped up guiltily, hearing the angry shouts below, but grinned when she saw the Cliffhurst fishing dinghy a short distance offshore, with Carl waving his arms at the dolphins diving playfully around the boat. Little Bonnie, swimming close to her mother, seemed to have quite recovered, Midge was pleased to see. The 2 middle-sized dolphins would be Titch and Bobo, but they looked so alike that she couldn't tell which was which.
"You go and catch your own fish!" Carl shouted. "You are scaring all my fish away. Go! Go!"
Midge watched the dolphins dive once more, then start to swim away. She chuckled when the last of them, was it Titch, came alongside the boat and leapt high out of the water, his head and tail wagging cheekily, before coming down with a tremendous splash, showering water all over Carl and his fishing gear.
"You devil, you, Titch!"
Carl shouted, waving his fist at the swiftly departing dolphin.
"You wait. I pay you back for that. You just see. You'll be sorry."
Midge almost laughed out loud. Titch's sense of humor hadn't gone down too well this time, anyway. She wished she could call out his name, and wondered if he'd remember her if she did. The distant sound of a truck's revving engine turned her attention back to Cliffhurst, and she gasped in surprise, focusing on the trailer with a sleek white cabin cruiser being manoeuvred into position above the boat ramp. Slowly the trailer began its journey down, with both Feldman and Brunston giving loud directions with much waving of arms to the truck driver. A third man stood watching laconically, his hands on his hips. Midge jumped, startled, as below her a boat engine coughed into life, and she watched as Carl set the dinghy on a fast course for home. Had the dolphins scared all the fish away, she wondered, or was Carl just curious to see the new boat? Well, she might as well stay and watch the launching herself, she thought. It could be interesting, and maybe something else would turn up that would be worth reporting to Chris when he rang. Alan Munnane glanced at his watch before putting down the bulletin he'd been reading, and glanced over at Chris, so deep into a magazine that he hadn't looked up. 35 minutes had passed since they had come to this small waiting room, after receiving Dr. Fenton's message asking them to meet him here at 11. The sister had warned them that as he was operating that morning, the doctor could be delayed, but Alan's mounting concern as he waited
had now made concentration on reading impossible. What was it that the doctor wanted to discuss, Alan wondered. Not any new complications, surely. He'd been delighted and relieved to see Paul so much better this morning. Although wasted and very pale, he seemed almost his old self. They'd greeted each other affectionately as always, and Paul was obviously very glad to see him, although he had tried to hide his emotion behind teasing laughter. Alan's thoughts were interrupted as Dr. Fenton hurried into the room, smiling a distracted greeting as Alan and Chris rose anxiously from their chairs.
"Sorry to keep you two waiting," he said, drawing up a chair. "A busy morning. Difficult to keep to time, you understand?"
"Of course," was Alan's quick reply.
"Paul is not worse, is he, Doctor?"
Dr. Fenton hesitated before replying.
"Well, no. He's responding very well, really. We still don't know what caused the deterioration, but it appears to have now been flushed from his system."
He paused, looking from one to the other.
"What I wanted to tell you was that it's necessary for Paul to have a kidney transplant as soon as possible, but as his tissue type is a fairly rare one, we have a kidney donor problem, you see."
"He can have one of mine."
Alan and Chris spoke as one, then looked at each other. Chris grinned.
"Great minds think alike, Uncle."
"Do either of you happen to know what your tissue type is?" the doctor inquired.
Both of the would-be donors shook their heads, having no idea.
"Well, then, the sooner we find out, the better."
Dr. Fenton smiled as he got up.
"A compatible tissue can sometimes be found in families, so I was hoping that one or both of you might volunteer. It's about our only chance, I'm afraid. But it's not an easy decision for anyone to make, living for the rest of your life with only one kidney."
The doctor looked searchingly at each in turn.
"Any second thoughts about it, either of you?"
The chorused answer was an emphatic no. Midge woke to the sound of rain drumming on the roof and distant thunder. Last night, when storms in the area had been forecast, she'd hoped the weather bureau would be wrong. After all, it often was. But if this weather kept up, how was she going to get away, she wondered. She'd been lucky with the weather this past week. Every morning, everyone had raced down to the beach after breakfast, some soon after sunrise if they wanted an early ski, and she'd been one of them. Midge was a good slalom skier and loved the sport. But she'd been going regularly with Bill Lumridge and a few of the others, mainly to prove that she wasn't being antisocial or had gone off her rocker, wanting to go rock climbing on her own so often. Luck was with Midge again today. By 8:30, the rain had stopped. The wind had calmed down and the sky was showing patches of blue, although there were still a few thunderclouds about and more were banking up on the horizon. Midge was having difficulty persuading her parents that the seas wouldn't be too rough for skiing when Bill Lumridge arrived, wanting to know if she was coming or not. Her father, who considered Bill a steady, responsible boy, finally said she could go, as Bill's father would be in charge of the boat. After Midge's recent narrow escape, Jeff and Hilary Beaumont wanted to make sure that their adventurous daughter took no further risks. Midge had begged her mates in the mob not to breathe a word about her solo climbing expeditions for that very reason. After an exhilarating 5-minute ride to the other side of the bay, giving the turbulent tunnel area wide berth as usual, Midge reached the small cove where Titch had brought her to shore. Beaching her sailboard on the tiny patch of sand, she untied the pair of old sneakers from around her neck and sat down to put them on. The rocks would be extra slippery today after the rain, and the climb up and then down to the studio cave wasn't going to be easy, she knew, even with her sneakers on. She was well behind schedule, but she'd been committed to having at least one ski. If she'd refused, Bill's father might have mentioned it to her parents. Luckily, 5 others had arrived, and as there was only one boat, she had the excuse to take the sailboard out while waiting her turn. Midge glanced at her watch. It was 9:45. It would be nearly an hour after high tide by the time she reached the cave. But it couldn't be helped. There might be something worth seeing once she got there, Midge thought, as she began the climb. She felt excited about her new role as a spy, but was determined not to be silly and hurry.
If she slipped and fell, it would put an end to the whole thing. And, as no one now at Cliffhurst knew about the back way, who would ever find her anyway? Everything was so quiet, even past the halfway mark, that Midge was beginning to think that the video rides for the dolphins must have been stopped. But, as she entered the last tunnel, she could hear them chattering excitedly and splashing about inside. She had just stepped out into the alcove when a tremendous bang sent her reeling back in fright. For a terrifying second, she thought someone had fired a high-powered rifle at her at close range, until she realized what she'd heard. Almost at once, there was a second clap of thunder, followed by a long, low rumbling that reverberated frighteningly around the cave walls. But the thunder obviously hadn't worried the dolphins. They were thoroughly enjoying what looked like an extremely hazardous white water ride down some rapids being shown on the big TV screen. Midge could see Brunston and Feldman sitting in the box-like room behind the glass wall at the stage end, watching what was happening on the small monitor screen and the dolphins' reactions to it. A third man in a wetsuit, goggles and flippers, who Midge thought must be Carl, was sitting with his legs dangling in the water, where an area of layered, flat rock, several meters wide, jutted out like an apron from the glassed-in stage. Midge was curious about the small canvas bag strapped around his waist. But what intrigued her most was the strange-looking grey contraption he was wearing. Something like a large rubber suction cap held on by straps under the chin protruded from the top of his wetsuit cap. This appeared to be connected by three thick straps down the back to a small cylinder attached to a flattish shoulder-wide satchel reaching halfway to his waist, with straps each side that were buckled up in front of his chest. Midge had never seen anything like it. She was making a mental note of what the contraption looked like, so as to be able to report it accurately to Chris, when there was another rumble of thunder, and Carl looked up quickly at the men behind the glass. Feldman, who had been watching him, turned to say something quietly to Brunston, who nodded in agreement and walked across to the big TV set. "Yes, we stop the video now, Carl," Feldman called. "The storm is not good for the TV." Then both screens went blank as Brunston pressed a button on the control panel. At once the dolphins began to slap at the water with their flippers, squeaking their disapproval at having been so suddenly deprived of their entertainment. But they seemed to accept the situation quite happily when Carl slipped into the water with them, and as they circled around him they chattered expectantly, as if this was part of a rehearsed routine. Now Carl was looking back to watch Feldman, who, Midge was surprised to see, had already reached the top of a short flight of wooden stairs behind the thick glass. Stepping carefully over this, he started to climb backwards down the railed steps cut into the cave wall that sloped steeply down to the flat rock shelf below. It was only then that Midge noticed that the fish box, now near the bottom of the steps, was too far back from the water for the dolphins to reach the paddle and help themselves to fish. There was another box beside it, and a sheet of grey metal, about a metre square with a wider bar across the top, was propped against the cave wall. "Here, Rex. Nice fish for you." Midge looked back to see that Carl and the dolphins were now close to the small entrance at the other end of the pool, and the biggest dolphin was now accepting the fish Carl held out to him. "Go, Rex. Go." Carl waved him off, watching the dolphin swim out as he reached inside the canvas bag for another fish. "Here, Titch. Nice fish for you, too." Again Carl held out a fish, which Titch took quickly, but quite graciously, before he too swam out. Midge smiled. They were just like polite guests leaving a party, with a farewell present as a bonus, she thought, as she watched Mary and Marnie, with Bonnie beside her, take their fishes and go. "Bobo! Come, Bobo!" A voice from the stage end called persuasively, just as Bobo, a slightly impatient last, was about to take his fish. He was still swallowing it as he turned. Then, seeing the mullet Feldman was waving, Bobo beeped happily and raced back for it. Brunston, who had climbed down to join Feldman, laughed.
"We make good choice, Gerard. Bobo is a greedy dolphin, all right."
Suddenly, From the other end came a metallic screeching noise, and Midge, startled, turned quickly to see Carl holding a heavy rope on a pulley attached to a sheet of clay-coloured metal that now came down with a resounding thud, closing off the cave entrance.
"They're keeping Bobo in," Midge thought in dismay, as she watched Carl repeat the same procedure on the only other entrance, a small cave at the side that she'd not noticed before. Then she realized that the top of the small entrance, being only just above the waterline now, would be entirely covered by water at high tide. The noises hadn't seemed to worry Bobo, who was enjoying his third fish by the time Carl had swum back. But did he realize he was locked in? Midge wondered. Brunston went over to the second box and took out what looked like another contraption, identical with the one Carl was wearing, and brought it over.
"Here, Carl," he said jokingly, as he leaned over to hand it across. "Now we see if Bobo looks so handsome as you in his one, eh?"
But when Carl held it out to show him, Bobo squeaked suspiciously, then did a quick about-turn and swam off. Feldman frowned.
"Bobo does not like it. You call him back, Carl. Give him a fish to make happy."
By this time, Bobo had swum to the main cave entrance and, finding his way blocked, swam agitatedly back and forth, beeping loudly in distress. Nor would he come when Carl called his name, tempting him with another fish. Even when Carl swam to him, the straps of the contraption gripped between his teeth and again offered the fish with coaxing words, Bobo butted his hand away and sped off. It was then that Midge saw that another dolphin had entered the cave, apparently from under the blocked side entrance. It was Titch. She recognized him now by the white mark above one eye. How on earth did he get in? She wondered. Titch swam at once to Bobo, and it was obvious that Bobo was glad to see him by his soft chatter and the affectionate way he pressed his head against that of his friend. Midge could see that the three men were staring in silent amazement until Feldman frowned, pointing angrily to Titch, who had swum across to Carl.
"Get him out, Carl. Get him out."
But Titch seemed to be curious about the contraption in Carl's hand and was tossing it about gently with his beak, as if he wanted Carl to let him have it. Carl made no move to obey Feldman's order and allowed the dolphin a closer look at the contraption before he spoke.
"Titch and Bobo are very good friends, Mr. Feldman," he said respectfully. "Bobo will be better if they are together, I think."
"But Titch will be a nuisance. He is not needed," Feldman replied impatiently.
"Titch is a very clever dolphin. He can watch. Teach Bobo, maybe," Carl persisted. "Titch found another way in, deep under the cave. He will come back anyway. So we try, please?" he asked.
"Better we try, Gerard," Brunston advised quietly. "Carl, I think, is right."
Feldman shrugged, then waved a hand in reluctant agreement.
"All right, Carl, you try."
By this time, Bobo had swum over to join Titch and Carl, and watched with interest as Carl began to stroke Titch as he held up the suction cup headpiece and put it against his own.
"See, Titch? I have one, too," Carl spoke quietly. "You like to wear this now? You show Bobo, eh?"
Titch nodded his head, gave two quick squeaks of agreement, sounding very like okay, Midge thought. Then he lay quietly as Carl gently harnessed the headpiece around his beak and head.
"You show Bobo how it looks, eh?"
he said as he adjusted the satchel behind Titch's dorsal fin like a saddle. Titch began to wag his tail, bobbing his head and chattering, as if encouraging Carl to hurry up and finish the job.
"He seems to know what they want," Midge thought as she watched. "Chris was right. Dolphins can read your mind, even if they don't understand the words you say."
Titch waited patiently until Carl had finished buckling the body strap underneath, then went into action. He sped off around the pool, showing off with a spectacular backwards tail walk, before coming back to circle his friend, chattering happily and butting Bobo playfully, as if reassuring him. At the other end of the pool, Brunston and Feldman clapped delightedly, calling out, "Bravo!"
Titch had put on a good show, and they were pleased that the contraption fitted him so well and without any apparent discomfort. Midge had almost clapped herself. As Titch was unharnessed, Bobo chattered excitedly. This time he seemed quite eager to wear the thing. But he stayed quiet while being harnessed up. Now it was his turn to show off. Bobo, as Chris had said, was a born clown, and the impressive show of aquatic acrobatics he was turning on drew spontaneous applause from all three men watching him. Midge had to be content with a broad grin of appreciation. "Carl, we try the target sheet now," Feldman called excitedly. Midge turned to watch the two men as they walked over to the grey metal sheet leaning against the cave wall. It seemed heavy as they carried it by its handles to the edge of the rock apron and fitted it down into a metal frame that had been bolted to the rock. She noticed that two circles had been painted on the other side of the thick metal sheet, which must be steel, she thought. A deep red outer circle, about 35 centimetres in diameter, contained a smaller black one, which Midge reckoned to be about 15 centimetres across. Both circles were well underwater by the time the sheet had been pushed down fully into its frame. Midge was intrigued. Whatever was going to happen next, she wondered. She didn't have long to wait, as Carl, who had now come up to within 4 metres of the target sheet, suddenly duck-dived, swimming underwater towards it. There was a dull thud as the suction cup on his head made contact with the inner black circle and stayed there. Midge wondered, if the thing was a suction cup, how long it would stick to the metal. But after a few seconds it came free, and Carl shot to the surface. Brunston and Feldman clapped enthusiastically, but both were watching the dolphins and not Carl, Midge noticed.
"Come, Bobo," Carl called, beckoning. "You do it now."
Carl knew Bobo well. After the recent applause he'd received, Bobo would be ready. He would think this a new game, and Bobo loved games. And Carl was right. The dolphin swam at once to the spot where Carl had duck-dived, and did the same thing, steering straight for the target sheet. And his aim was spot-on, too. The suction cup hit the black circle with a resounding bang. But the loud noise seemed to startle him, as he came up shaking his head bewilderedly, until he saw the mullet Carl was waving. Then, his fright forgotten, Bobo swam up to accept the fish as Brunston and Feldman gave him another round of applause. Midge smiled. "He's just like a pro performer," she thought, and almost laughed when Bobo gave them a spirited tail walk as an encore. Or was it instead of a bow? These dolphins were amazing creatures.
"Bobo did well, yes?"
Carl grinned triumphantly up at the two men watching.
"But the tide's going out quickly, and the water's getting too shallow. We let them out now?"
Midge looked at her watch and was shocked to see that it was more than an hour since she'd left Bill, saying she'd be back in time for her next ski. She'd better get back. But what a morning it had been! She hadn't a clue what it was all about, but she knew Chris would be just as intrigued as she was when she told him. And she'd be back here again tomorrow morning, no matter what, she thought as she turned to go. Feldman and Brunston, seated at the lunch table, ceased talking as Rita came in with a bowl of salad. She was dressed ready to go out. They had given the Rimmers the rest of the day off and the use of the car to go to Newcastle. Carl was to finalise the delivery of the four-wheel drive vehicle ordered for tomorrow, but their main reason for suggesting that Rita go with Carl was that Stefan and Gerard wanted complete privacy for what they planned to do this afternoon.
"Thank you, Rita,"
Stefan smiled toothily up at her, his hand touching hers as he took the bowl.
"This looks excellent salad. You take much trouble always."
"It's no trouble, Mr. Brunston," was Rita's nonchalant reply.
Soon after the Rimmers had left, Stefan followed Gerard along the passage leading to the study, one of the two rooms Paul Manane had built onto the house, extending it towards the outer bay side of the cliff. Stefan enjoyed the company of women, and the isolation here at Cliffhurst, coupled with Gerard's condescending attitude, had taken the edge off the excitement he'd felt on being chosen for this top-secret project, admitting him and Gerard to the elite special branch of the party. Both were highly qualified in science and marine biology, and before their selection had become quite good friends during the intensive preparation course and further tests required of the top candidates. They had been careful, since taking over Cliffhurst, not to alter the former routine too much, and had decided that, except for the two locked desk drawers, anything resembling secrecy should be avoided as far as Carl and Rita were concerned. To invite their curiosity, especially Rita's, would be dangerous. Carl had been told a very interesting, but mostly fictitious, version of the project MMRI had commissioned them to carry out. And any questions had always been answered readily, although the answers often bore little resemblance to the truth. Both Gerard and Stefan had been well trained in this respect. The Rimmers had been most cooperative, even months before Cliffhurst had been sold. Feldman and Brunston had seen to that by rewarding them most handsomely for information asked for in letters Brunston had written to Carl. These were always friendly, expressing interest in the Rimmers' new life in Australia and in Dr. Manane's important work with the dolphins. And the questions asked were mostly of a fairly general nature, such as the distance between Tunnel Bay and Newcastle, and interested requests for more detailed descriptions of the two bays and the dangerous tunnel gap between them. Each letter had also contained 5 Australian $100 notes. "The money," Brunston wrote in his first letter, "is a small gift from myself and Mr. Feldman to help you two young people in Australia who wish one day to buy your own restaurant, where Rita can show Australian people her good cooking. You are wise not to have told Dr. Monane of your plans. I am sure he would not like for you to leave his employ." In conclusion, Brunston had added that it would be best not to mention receiving his letter, or the money, to anyone. If the good doctor should hear about either of them, it would be embarrassing for them all. So Carl should burn the letter at once. After receiving Carl's grateful reply, Brunston wrote back to say how very sorry he and Mr. Feldman were to learn from his letter that Dr. Manane was not well. "Trouble with the kidneys is a painful complaint, and the good doctor is very foolish not to take any medication to ease the pain. You say he likes the barley water and lemon drink, and this is quite beneficial. But a new medication has been discovered over here, which is having wonderful results with sufferers from kidney complaints. It is so new that perhaps it may not yet have been released in Australia. Now I am sending you some in this small packet enclosed. As it is still in very short supply, it must be kept for the doctor only. Tell Rita this, please, and to stir 1 small levelled teaspoon of powder into the glass of barley water, but only once each day. She should not mention it to the good doctor, or he will be angry with me, and Rita also. He sounds a very nice man, and certainly very clever, but a little stubborn, I think. But we all must try for him to be well again, so he can continue his good work." Stefan followed Gerard into the study. It was a pleasant room, functional and well equipped for both work and comfort, with a couch, coffee table, and easy chairs grouped around the large window overlooking the bay. Well-filled bookshelves, cupboards, and a computer console filled all of the east wall behind the heavy wooden desk. A second door in the north wall, with more bookshelves on each side of it, was closed. Stefan waited with mounting excitement as Gerard unlocked the bottom drawer in the desk and took out a videotape. It had arrived the day before by special delivery, and knowing what it contained, both men had been looking forward to viewing it just once more. Now, with both Carl and Rita safely away from the house, the time had come. Seeing the precious tape safely in Gerard's hand, Stefan hurried to open the side door. He felt the gusts of cold, dank air coming up through a small gap of about 30 centimetres between the double walls. Now he faced another door and leaned across to slide it back. As he stepped over the gap and into the next room, the floor shuddered slightly. Quickly he switched on the light. It was the same small room, with the big TV, that Midge had seen behind the glass in the studio cave. Stefan stood back as Gerard stepped across into the room, closing both doors before pressing a button on a small panel by the door. A slight jolt, then the lift began its slow, purring descent to the cave below. The lift had barely settled on its base in the cave when Gerard put the tape down on the table. "We use the big screen," he said decisively. "We will lift TV backwards. Help, please."
"There he goes again, taking charge as usual," Stefan was thinking resentfully as he helped move the heavy set.
But he had to admit that it was a good idea. They could miss some important detail if watching the film on the small monitor screen, and, as each frame would be erased as soon as it had been shown, there could be no replay. Stefan took comfort in the fact that it had been his idea that they come down to the cave for the viewing. He'd pointed out that if Carl and Rita should return for some reason, they would not be disturbed, and, as it would be low tide at 3 o'clock, the water would be so shallow that the dolphins could not come in.
"Not even ditch," Stefan had added, laughing.
Stefan had spoken in their mother tongue, and realizing this, Gerard frowned.
"You break the rules, Stefan," he reprimanded. "We must always speak English. We improve. It is necessary."
Stefan shrugged.
"How will we improve when no one is here now who can teach us better speaking?"
"Then from Carl we learn, Stefan. He speaks good English." Stefan shrugged again. He considered his English quite as good as Carl's, but decided not to say so, and promptly changed the subject. The two men, Gerard holding the remote control, and Stefan with pen poised ready to take notes, watched the big screen intently. As there could be no reverse, split-second decisions would have to be made, whether to freeze a frame or use slow motion. The narrator, a charismatic, dark-haired man in his late 50s, was known to them both as Alex, their party leader and a brilliant scientist. It was he who had first conceived, then organized, the Dolphin Connection Project. He was also the inventor of the grey rubber harness-like contraption spread out on a table in front of him. It was identical to those Gerard and Stefan had been using, but the flattened satchel appeared empty. Also on the table were wrapped and numbered packages of varying sizes, a small cylinder, and several short strands of thin wire with terminals at each end.
"The assembly is very simple," Alex was saying as he picked up a very small packet labelled number 1. "These will be inserted in consecutive numbers from top to bottom and from left to right."
At this point, Gerard froze the frame, watching as Stefan wrote.
"This already we know," he said, "but it's best to write all down now."
There were many stops and a number of slow motions before the 20-minute demonstration was over, and Stefan's notes, written in his large ornate script, had filled 6 pages. To all outward appearances, what they had seen was a simple assembly demonstration. Alex always took precautions. At no time had he mentioned by name what the numbered packets contained or what the loaded contraption was intended for. He was also well aware that, if the right people were watching, there was no need. The two men were in the study when the phone rang at 4:30. Stefan, sitting at the study desk, picked up the receiver.
"Cliffhurst, Brunston speaking."
His voice was casual. Gerard looked up from the book he was reading and watched Stefan's jaw drop as he listened.
"What?"
Stefan almost shouted, then listened with growing alarm.
"Sometime Sunday? But that is only 5 days. We are..."
The speaker interrupted him. Gerard had come quickly to Stefan's side and, with one ear almost against the receiver, listened for a few seconds before grabbing it away angrily. Stefan, furious, glared and almost hit him, but stood up to listen himself, having decided that the need to hear what was being said was more important than anything else.
"This is Feldman," Gerard interrupted. "Why you not inform us more early?" he demanded angrily. "You too lazy on job," he finished scathingly.
Now the man's voice rose angrily.
"You just watch it, Feldman. I'll not take that from you or anyone. The fact is, they've suddenly put 5 more experts on the job. Nobody bloody knew they were going to, did they?"
"Is your job to find out?" Gerard retorted,
"Alex will not like this news. You have told him?"
"I've just come off the phone. He didn't sound too worried. Says he's still counting on you to fulfill your contract, whatever that is."
A short laugh.
"Alex doesn't give much away, you know. He says not to ring him, just get cracking and go ahead as planned."
"Cracking? What he mean?" Feldman asked, puzzled.
"Move it!" The man at the other end laughed disparagingly. "Keep your hair on. Tomorrow's only Wednesday. I'll keep you posted."
The man was still laughing as he hung up. Wednesday. Midge woke with a feverish cold. It had been very chilly down in the cave the day before, and now she realized she should have taken a sweater with her. She felt bitterly disappointed that she couldn't go to the cave that morning. But she had no option but to obey her mother's instructions to stay in bed. When Chris rang at 2 o'clock, Midge was asleep, and Hillary answered the phone. Chris, obviously disappointed at not being able to speak to Midge, commiserated about her cold.
"Hello, Mrs. Beaumont?"
"Yes?"
"Chris Manane here. Can I speak to Midge, please?"
"I'm afraid she's asleep, Chris. She's got a bad cold, and I'd rather not wake her."
"Oh, sorry she's not well. Could you tell her, please, that Dad's had a kidney transplant? Uncle Alan was the donor. Dad and Alan are both okay. I'm still at the motel, and I'll ring her tomorrow evening about 7.
"Okay, Chris. I'm glad your dad's all right. I'll certainly give Midge your message when she wakes up. Look after yourself, and let us know if there's anything we can do to help. Bye for now." She put down the phone thoughtfully.
"Oh, Mum, that's not fair. You could have woken me," Midge wailed when she was told later that Chris had rung. "There was something important I wanted to tell him."
"Well, surely it's not so important that it can't wait until tomorrow," her mother sounded annoyed.
"I left you asleep because I thought it best for you, that's all."
As her mother was speaking, Midge realized that, with her listening, she couldn't have told Chris about what had happened yesterday in the cave anyway.
"I know. And it's okay, Mum," she said, deciding to make the best of it. "I'll tell him tomorrow."
At 9 o'clock, Midge, feeling drowsy after being dosed with all the cold cures her mother could think of, switched off her bedside lamp and lay back, thinking about Chris and the missed phone call. "If only I'd been awake," Midge thought. "It would have been good just to talk. He's got a nice voice, sort of deep, like a cello. And I like that tiny trace of an English accent, too. Come to think of it, I like a lot of things about Chris." Midge smiled drowsily. "And I'm glad he knows about Wiggy. And him having a birthmark, too, makes it something to share. He's not paranoid about his, like me, and maybe it is a lucky sign, like his mother said. Touched by the gods. I like that." Midge sighed. "I wish my mother had said that when I was little. Anyway, if anyone else sees Wiggy, that's what I'll say from now on," she decided as she closed her eyes. Thursday. The sun was well up when Midge woke. A quick look at her watch told her that she'd slept in. She felt much better, though, she decided, admitting to herself that it was probably due to all those cold cures she'd had to swallow yesterday. Being an ex-nurse, Hilary Beaumont still loved to get back into her stride when Midge or Midge's dad was sick, and both of them knew better than to argue against taking her medications. But Midge still didn't feel up to another trip to the cave, not that she'd be allowed to go out anyway. She could hear ski boats out on the bay and wished she could be down there with the rest of the gang. She hated being in bed, doing nothing. "Well, come on, Midge," she told herself. "Stop whinging. Get out of bed and do something, then." Hillary was pleased to have Midge's help with the chores, and over lunch the two of them enjoyed a leisurely chat, rare enough these days. At 4 o'clock, Midge, having been banished from the kitchen, relaxed on the patio with her book on Greek mythology. Reading about Apollo, she remembered how she'd thought Chris was his spitting image when she first saw him. But was he? Finding the page with the photograph of the statue of Apollo, she studied the blank, unsmiling face and wondered why she'd ever thought the two were alike. Chris was much more handsome. Definitely. His face had much more character. More strength in the chin. more sensitivity about the mouth, more... Midge suddenly realized how much she missed him.
"Still reading that book, Midge?" Hilary smiled at her daughter as she put the tray with two iced drinks down on the table beside her and sat down. "Here, there's some nice garlic in yours," Hilary teased as she handed Midge her glass. Midge screwed up her face.
"Oh, thanks a lot, Mum."
Then laughing, "You're mad on that garlic, aren't you? Just as well I'm not going out anywhere. I'd be avoided like the plague."
"It's done you good, anyway," Hilary sipped her drink thoughtfully.
"That reminds me, I must make a shopping list. I'll have to go down to Newcastle tomorrow morning. Want to come with me, Midge?"
Midge hesitated.
"Well, yes, I think I might, Mum."
She'd been about to refuse, as it would be a good chance to go to the cave, but a sudden idea made her change her mind.
"Mum, would you mind if I invited Chris up here this weekend? It must be pretty dreary going backwards and forwards to the hospital all the time."
Then, as her mother hesitated, Midge went on persuasively.
"Well, his father seems to be recovering all right, so missing a couple of days wouldn't matter too much, would it?"
"Well, Chris would have to decide about that, Midge," Hilary smiled. "But it's all right with me, dear, if that's what you'd like. And Chris is a nice boy. Your father and I both thought so." When Chris rang at 6:45, he seemed surprised at Midge's invitation, but accepted at once. Eventually, it was arranged that Midge and her mother would pick Chris up at his motel at 11:30 the following morning, and her father would drop him off on his way back to Sydney on Sunday night. Midge was delighted. Chris had sounded as if he really wanted to come, and the fact that he'd seemed quite surprised to be asked was another good sign. The two of them could have at least a couple of spy sessions together, too. It would be too late, by the time they got back tomorrow, to catch high tide at the cave, but they could watch from the cliff later in the afternoon, and she could fill Chris in on the latest happenings at the cave on the climb up. Midge grinned to herself.
"Oh, boy! Having him here for the whole weekend will be just fabulous!"
Friday.
It was all great fun, really. Titch and Bobo seemed to think so, too.
Finishing her story, Midge laughed up at Chris as he helped her to the top of the cliff. Now Midge took the lead, heading for her lookout spot. Chris followed, deep in thought.
"I wonder what that contraption, as you call it, was for," he said almost to himself.
"It just looked like some sort of harness for an underwater game to me," said Midge. Suddenly she ducked, with Chris close behind. Both had seen the white cabin cruiser anchored out in the bay.
"That's their new boat out there. Maybe we're onto something,"
Midge whispered excitedly. Chris had the binoculars out of the knapsack already and was now focusing on the boat.
"Feldman and Brunston are on board," he reported.
"And there's something, looks like a slide, half out over the stern. And is that the target sheet you were talking about?" Chris handed the binoculars over.
"Here, have a look, Midge, up near the bow."
Midge studied the boat for a few seconds.
"Well, it looks like the one in the cave, but I think this one's only painted aluminium, judging by the way it bends to the shape of the boat. It must be clipped on."
"Good grief!" Chris exclaimed, staring across at Cliffhurst. "Those two grey box things on the lower landing jetty with Carl, see? They look like open coffins." He held out his hand for the binoculars.
"Quick, Midge, let's have a look."
Midge squinted across as she handed the binoculars over.
"Well, if they are, they're full of water and Carl's feeding one of the bodies a fish," she chuckled.
"Yes, a dolphin's strapped inside. There's another dolphin in the other one, too. Titch and Bobo by the size of them." Chris sounded as if he couldn't believe it. "The one taking the fish is probably Bobo, and it looks as if he's wearing that contraption, Midge. What the hell's going on?"
"Well, we'll soon know. Carl's letting Bobo go, I think," said Midge. "And he'll make straight for the boat, you'll see."
The two watched as Carl tipped the coffin on its side, spilling both water and the occupant out onto the landing. Launching himself with a spectacular leap, Bobo hit the water with a loud splash, then charged off towards the boat, about 100 meters offshore.
"You're right, Midge. And just look at him go!"
"Shh, Chris. Keep your voice down or they'll hear you," Midge whispered.
"Bullseye!"
Midge exclaimed as the dolphin hit the target just visible under the waterline.
"He's stuck there." "No, up he comes now," Chris sounded relieved.
"Wow!" Midge nudged Chris excitedly. "Did you see that leap up under the slide then? They've tipped it back like a seesaw. What are they doing now, Chris? I can't see."
"Looks as if they're undoing the straps on the harness thing and making one hell of a fuss over Bobo while they're about it. It's pathetic," Chris added disgustedly. "He's a wild creature, not a circus performer."
"From what I've seen of Bobo, he loves it, though," Midge chuckled softly. "And now he's getting his reward, see? Brunston's feeding him with fish."
"They're tipping the slide up now," Chris went on with the commentary. "And Bobo's away."
"And just look at him showing off," Midge chuckled.
"And here comes Titch to join him," Chris added. "Carl must have let him out of his tub."
"I'm glad you didn't say coffin," Midge said seriously. "The word sounds so grim somehow."
"Well, I would say the game's over for today, Midge," Chris said, watching the boat. "They're about to bring the boat in now, by the look of it."
"Hey," cried Midge. "I've not seen the other dolphins around." She looked at Chris anxiously. "They must all be still locked up in the cave." Chris turned to watch the house.
"Carl's just going inside now. And don't worry, Midge. Carl really loves those dolphins. He's probably on his way down to let them out right now," he assured her.
"Ah, good." Midge sounded relieved as she looked up at a sky that threatened rain. "I hope it doesn't rain tomorrow, Chris. I'm dying to get back to that cave. And you too, I'll bet."
"Yes, I've really missed the place," Chris replied. "But I've been away so long I've lost track of the high tides." He grinned at her. "So, what time are we aiming for tomorrow, Midge?"
2:08 in the afternoon," Midge grinned back. "Let's go home for a game of table tennis. Are you on?"
"Ready, willing, and able," was Chris's laughing reply. Soon after 6, Jeff Beaumont's white BMW drove into the double carport. Hillary had told him of Chris Munane's impending visit, and now he was quite looking forward to meeting him again. "He's a decent kid," he thought, "and if he hadn't been there when the dolphin brought Midge ashore that day, she might have drowned. But it was the dolphin that saved her, really. An amazing thing, that." After dinner, the four played cards, and as they finished the game, Hillary looked across at Midge. "I think you ought to go to bed now, Midge dear," she said. "You'll want to be fit for Sandy's party tomorrow night."
"Oh, Mum," Midge objected. "Stop fussing, will you? I feel fine."
"Well, I think you should, anyway," Hillary insisted quietly. Chris, who thought Midge still looked a bit washed out, came to Hillary's rescue. "Well," he smiled across at her, "I'll need to be fighting fit for that early ski tomorrow, so I wouldn't say no to a good night's sleep myself." After Midge and Chris had gone upstairs together, Midge was disappointed when Chris, after a quick, "Good night, Midge, sleep well," went on to his room. But then, maybe he really was shy with girls. He'd said so that first day, she remembered. Later, she'd almost reached the bathroom door when Chris came out. Midge stood aside to let him pass, and the two looked uncertainly at each other, until Chris reached out, took her face between his hands, and planted a kiss firmly on her lips. Chris seemed to be waiting for her to make the next move, and Midge was about to initiate it when she suddenly remembered yesterday's garlic. The smell might be still there, and she hadn't cleaned her teeth. Flustered, she said the first words that came into her head.
"Do you eat garlic?" she asked.
Chris chuckled. He knew why she'd asked. "Yes, Midge, I do. We both ate it tonight at dinner." His head came closer. "And I like it garden fresh." He bent to kiss her again, very gentle at first, as his arms felt their way around her. Then, as the kiss deepened, Midge felt a delicious melting away, until she seemed to rise and float upwards, buoyant in the wind, light as thistledown. When Chris suddenly drew away, throwing his head up with a sharp intake of breath, Midge came back reluctantly to earth,
surprised to find that she was trembling. And so was Chris. "Good night, Midge," Chris muttered as he turned away and hurried to his room. Midge, leaning back against the wall, watched him go, wanting him to stay. She'd been kissed lots of times and quite enjoyed it, but she'd never felt like this before. Ever. Saturday. The skies that had threatened rain the night before opened up soon after midnight, and by 8 o'clock it looked as if the rain had settled in for the day. Somehow Midge wasn't too disappointed about missing another cave trip, but it was obvious that Chris was. "Did you bring your panpipes, Chris?" she asked at breakfast. "Yes," mumbled Chris, his mouth full of cereal. "I did, as a matter of fact. Why, Midge?"
"Well, my guitar's here, so I thought it might be fun to see how they sound together. What do you think?"
Chris's face lit up.
"Great idea. Yes, let's try."
2 hours later, they were still playing, Midge instinctively finding the right chords and harmonies, and Chris changing to any key, when there was a phone call for Midge.
"The gang are setting up a game of indoor bowls after lunch, Chris. Are you on?" Midge asked at the door.
"Yes, if you are," Chris replied. "Sounds fun." Chris had not played indoor bowls before, but quickly picked up the technique and was soon playing as well as most of the others. He fitted in well, Midge noticed.
And they all seemed to like him, except Bill Lumridge, who had been giving him dirty looks ever since they'd arrived, and had avoided them both, not that she cared much.
They were changing teams for the second round when Sandy Wilson edged up to Midge.
"Wow!"
Sandy rolled her blue eyes, tossed her long blonde hair, and almost purred.
"I like your Chris. He's all man," she breathed.
"Down, pussycat," Midge growled. "He's all mine." They fell about laughing.
"Okay, I get the message.
But be warned," Sandy added melodramatically. "I'll be wearing my new killer whale bathers tonight. They're black and white, and they're a knockout." Midge laughed confidently.
"Go for your life, then. But you won't get to first base with Chris."
The rain had stopped by the time Midge and Chris started off on their walk home after the game. It was 4:30, and the others wouldn't be far behind them, as Sandy's pool party was to start at 7.
"Let's not go home just yet," Midge said. "How about a walk down to the beach first?"
Chris grinned.
"Great minds think alike, Midge. I was about to suggest just that. But do you mind if I go and get my pipes first? We'd better change, too. If there's a good deep pool, we'll probably have to climb over rocks to get there."
"Okay, then," Midge agreed. "And I've a fair idea what you want to do, too. Play your pipes and see if Titch will come."
Chris laughed. "Exactly, Midge. The tide's out, so it's not likely that Titch will be involved at Cliffhurst. And if he hears me, I'm sure he'll come."
30 minutes later, Chris played his pipes as he and Midge sat together on the edge of the deepest pool they could find with access to the sea, and waited. A few minutes later, Titch arrived. Swimming to Chris at once, he slid up onto the rock, uttering soft keening sounds of unmistakable relief and pleasure, as Chris fondled his head, laughing.
"Good old Titch! It's so good to see you!"
Slipping back into the water, the dolphin swam to the other side and slid up beside Midge. Midge, touched and delighted, stroked him affectionately.
"Oh, Chris! I think he remembers me!"
"Of course he does," Chris laughed, leaning across for a quick kiss. "And who wouldn't?" The three stayed there for almost an hour. When it was time for them to go, Chris called Titch up beside him to say goodbye.
"We've got to go now, Titch," he told him quietly. "But we'll see you tomorrow in the TV cave. We'll be up in the alcove watching, but we don't want anyone to see us there."
Titch uttered the same two quick squeaks that sounded like "okay," nodding his head as he slipped back into the water and swam slowly away.
"He really seemed to understand everything you said then, Chris," Midge smiled up at him as they walked, hand in hand, back along the beach.
"But it's not really words that dolphins understand, Midge. It's the transmitted pictures and thoughts projected from one mind to the other, and Titch catches on far better with me than I do with him."
"What pictures did you transmit just now, then?"
Well, when I said we had to go, I gave him a picture of us, walking away along the beach, just as he would see it. Then I showed him the two of us up in the cave wall. He'd guess the time, as it's always high tide when he's there with the others. Then, when I said we didn't want anyone to see us, it was a thought picture projection, depicting Brunston and Feldman as undesirables to be kept away. That's amazing, Chris. Do you think dolphins are really more intelligent than we are, then?
Yes. I'm convinced of it, Midge.
It was just on 7:30 when Midge and Chris arrived at the Wilsons. Fairy lights were strung everywhere, and already the party was well underway. Loud rock music blared above the noisy laughter as someone, dressed as a clown, fooled around on the end of the diving board. Miming terror, he tried to escape several times, but was laughingly pushed back again. Deciding to brave the water at last, he looked down, shuddered violently, lost his balance, and with arms and legs flailing wildly, fell into the pool amidst laughter and loud applause.
"Come on, Sandy!" someone called. "Show him how it's done!"
Sandy Wilson laughed as she left the group she was with, shedding her white beach robe as she reached the board. Immediately there were whistled catcalls from the boys, all except Chris, Midge noticed with relief. But Sandy really did look stunning, Midge thought, as she watched her walk to the end of the board and stand poised for a few seconds before executing a perfect swallow dive, again to rowdy applause. As Chris joined in, Midge felt a twinge of jealousy, but shrugged it off. Later, after a water polo game, there was an underwater swimming competition. Bill Lumridge's effort of 2.5 pool lengths had been the best by 1/2 length when it was Chris's turn. And when he came up after 3 lengths, everyone cheered and clapped enthusiastically. But Midge, as she joined them, knew Chris could easily have stayed under much longer. She'd watched him do it, fishing for abalone that first day. 3 hours later, Midge slipped into bed, turned off the lamp and lay back, smiling, closing her eyes. Remembering all the stops on tonight's fabulous walk home, she tried to conjure up once more that delicious melting-away feeling, but it would not come. They had all day tomorrow, though, and it was going to be a wonderful day, she was thinking, as still smiling, she drifted off to sleep. Sunday. At 8 o'clock, Feldman and Brunston sat down to breakfast, served somewhat distractedly by Carl.
"Rita! She's not up?"
Brunston asked, as he took his plate of scrambled eggs from the tray.
"Rita is not well, Mr. Brunston," Carl replied. "Since early morning she feel ill and has bad pains in stomach."
"Oh, that is too bad, Carl," Brunston sympathized. "I am sorry."
"A little gastric trouble she has, that is all, Carl," Feldman comforted. "I will give her some colantal medicine for sickness in stomach and the aspirin for pain. Then Rita will feel better very soon."
"I hope so, Mr. Feldman,"
Carl, unsmiling, put Gerard's plate down in front of him.
"Mr. Feldman studied for Doctor of Medicine, you know," Brunston said, holding up a well-loaded fork. "He knows much about curing the sickness."
But Feldman chose to ignore the compliment. "Carl, please go down now to cave. Extend leads to speaker," he ordered. "We will come in 1/2 hour to test sound. Is important to be sure is working well." With the tide out, only a few pools of water remained in the floor of the cave. And with the ladder, it wasn't too difficult for Carl to hang the extended lead over the iron pegs he had hammered high up in the wall the day before. But carrying the speaker across the slippery floor, putting it in place on a ledge outside the cave entrance, then attaching the wires to it, was far from easy. Why go to so much extra trouble, Carl was thinking, as he carried the ladder back towards the glass wall. It seemed stupid, the two of them wanting to leave before high tide. Surely they could have waited until then. The dolphins would come in, the same as always. So why bring them early? What was the hurry? It was full moon, so he knew that today's tide would be very high. But Feldman's explanation, that they wanted to get back before dark, to release Bobo, as he'd not been used to being so long in his tub, just didn't make sense. They would be away the same time, no matter what time they left. Did they think him stupid not to realize that? Carl propped the ladder against the cave wall and shrugged. Well, it was their business, he supposed. He looked back, making sure that all was ready, and then down at the two grey metal tubs lying together on the rock ledge, each with its wide rubber sling inside and top straps open, empty and waiting. At 11 o'clock, Carl hitched the boat trailer to the new four-wheel drive, backed it down the boat ramp, then hurried up to the house, anxious to see how Rita was. He was about to go to their room when Brunston, a notepad in his hand and wearing shorts and a flowered shirt, came into the hall.
"Carl, we wish to take the fishing gear. Get it, please, and two rods, and take them down to the boat. Some bait we will need also."
Carl gaped in surprise.
"You go fishing today?"
Brunston laughed.
"Well, why we not fish, Carl? Is nice day for the fishing, no?"
But Carl did not smile.
"You say before you hurry back for Bobo. How you have time for fishing, then?"
For a moment Brunston looked taken aback, then smiled placatingly.
"Mr. Feldman did not tell you. Our colleagues from MMRI to drive all the way from Melbourne. Perhaps we must wait for them. So then we fish, the same time we wait."
He laughed, throwing out his hands.
"You see?"
Carl looked away. He didn't believe the story. Feldman had said the men were flying to Sydney, then driving up from there. But he would let it pass. He wanted to go and see Rita.
"Please, first, could I go to see Rita, how she is? Then at once I will get fishing things and bait ready."
Brunston, not wishing to argue the point, nodded impatiently as he ticked off listed items on the pad. Feldman was in the study when Carl came to the door, looking worried.
"Rita, she is worse, Mr. Feldman. The stomach pains are very bad now, so please," he begged, "will you ring for the doctor to come?"
Feldman reached for the phone on the desk. "Of course, Carl," he sounded concerned.
"I will call Dr. Trent. I will tell him and hear what he says."
Carl listened anxiously while Feldman described Rita's symptoms in his halting English and said what medication she had been given that morning. Then, after asking for the doctor's advice, he listened carefully, thanked him, and put down the phone.
"Dr. Trent says is gastric infection Rita has. There is much about this area now. He says medication given is correct, and she should have again at noon." "Thank you, Mr. Feldman, thank you."
Relieved, Carl turned to go.
"I will tell Rita now."
But Carl had not seen Feldman's finger press the bottom phone button as soon as he'd dialed the number, disconnecting the line. 20 minutes later, Carl brought the fishing creel and rods down to the boat. He was looking for the best place to put them when he noticed the extra drum of petrol in the corner of the cabin. It had not been there earlier. Why were they taking extra petrol when there was twice as much as they'd need on board already? Carl was beginning to feel distinctly uneasy about this trip.
"They have not told me the truth."
Carl was still resentful about it as he packed a hamper of food in the kitchen after an early lunch. There were other questions he would like to ask as well, but dared not. With Feldman's quick temper, he could lose his job. He must remember, too, that Brunston and Feldman had been very generous all along. He and Rita both enjoyed working at Cliffhurst, and from what he'd heard, they were being paid much more than the usual rate. No, Carl decided, as he fastened the lid on the hamper. There was nothing to worry about, really. And after all, he could not expect to be told everything. And Rita must be feeling a lot better after her last medication, as she'd been fast asleep when he'd gone in a few minutes ago. Brunston and Feldman had the motor idling as Carl, carrying the hamper, approached the boat at the jetty. They're having a final check-up, he thought. He was about to go aboard when the motor cut out, and hearing his name, he ducked down, listening.
"Suspicious, I think," Brunston was saying. "He asks questions and not believe me. He acts very strange."
Feldman laughed disparagingly.
His wife is sick, is all. We will tell him it is a trial and demonstration only today. Why he not believe that? He shook his head. No, Stefan, is you the suspicious one? He looked at his watch. But we waste the time. We go up now. Karl froze in panic. They were leaving the boat. He must think what to do, and deciding, stood up. With a flood of relief, he saw that both men still had their backs to him. Watching them, he crept backwards, waiting for them to turn, praying that the boards on the jetty would not creak. Karl was 3 meters away when he met their surprised stares with a grin.
"Rita is much better," he called cheerfully. "She sleeps sound now."
He held up the hamper.
"See, I bring the hamper. I remember to put wine and whiskey inside."
"Good, good," Feldman said. Taking the hamper, he handed it to Brunston, gesturing for him to put it inside the cabin.
"It's almost time, Karl. Best you change into wetsuit now. We will follow you down."
"He did hear us, what we said," Brunston sounded convinced as they climbed the cliff steps up to the house.
"Boards on jetty squeak when people walk on it, but we did not hear boards squeak, no?"
Yes, Feldman said thoughtfully. "Karl did pretend a little too much to be cheerful. I think he tried to make us think he did not hear."
"Of course he did. I tell you, Karl is too dangerous for us."
Brunston eagerly pressed the point.
"Karl will say nothing," Feldman assured him. "He would not dare risk his job."
Chris and John Wilson were sitting on the jetty at Outer Bay, talking, when Midge ran up to them.
"You're next, John. They're waiting."
Shivering, she grabbed her towel and began to rub herself down.
"All right."
John got up.
"See you two later," he called as he ran off.
Suddenly Midge stopped, listening. "No, I'm not dreaming. It is panpipes I can hear, and coming from Cliffhurst, too. Who could be playing them, Chris?"
"Me," Chris answered, looking up.
"Oh, come on," Midge laughed. "Pull the other leg."
"They're playing a practice tape I left behind."
"Okay, you win.
But something's happening over there all the same. Hadn't we better go and see?"
"Yes," Chris agreed.
He took her hand as both of them got up and ran for their sailboards further down the beach. 20 minutes later, Chris and Midge stepped into the alcove inside the cave. The dolphins were enjoying a yacht race showing on the big TV screen, but there was no one in the room behind the glass. Titch, strapped in his tub, seemed quite unruffled, and the other dolphins took no notice as Bobo, in his, was being pushed by Karl out of the cave entrance.
"They're taking Bobo out for target practice," said Midge. "Let's go up and watch from the cliff."
"Okay, but hang on a bit," Chris replied, staring down. "I want to make sure Titch knows we're here." The two watched as Titch continued to flip his tail from side to side, chattering and nodding his head.
"Right, let's go then," said Chris, turning away. "He knows where we'll be, and that we'll be back later."
By the time they reached the top of the cliff, Bobo's tub had already been loaded into the boat. The dinghy was tied up at the landing, and Karl was hurrying up the cliff steps towards the house. Midge looked at Chris in surprise.
"They must be taking Bobo somewhere in the boat."
"It certainly looks like it," Chris replied, watching Karl heading for the shed beside the house.
Chris was thinking quickly. If he cut back to the house now and could get down to the shed in time, he could find out from Karl what was going on. He was fairly certain that Karl could be trusted not to give him away.
"Stay here, Midge," he whispered. "I'm going to have a shot at getting to the shed, so I can speak to Karl."
Midge looked alarmed, but Chris was already on his way, and she dared not call out. Anxiously, she turned to watch the two men in the boat, in case they should look up. But Feldman was busy restacking boxes around the side, and Brunston was bending over Bobo, patting him and splashing him with water from his tub. And Bobo was not wearing his contraption this time, she noticed. Karl had almost reached the shed door when he heard his name called in a sharp whisper and stopped short.
"It's Chris, Karl. I'm behind the shed. Can you come around the back?"
Before Karl had a chance to answer, there came a shout from the boat.
"Karl,
Bring 2 boxes, and be quick.
Turning, Carl could see Brunston waving impatiently at him. He could do nothing but wave back in acknowledgement and go into the shed. Once inside, Carl rapped on the back wall, then called softly,
Chris, I cannot. They are watching. Go, please, to Studio Cave. You let Titch go. I will follow you down after they leave.
Carl seemed scared of them now, Chris realized with relief. He'd not give him away.
Okay, Carl,
he called back quietly. Chris listened for the shed door to bang shut, waited another 30 seconds, then made his way back to Midge. Brunston's tone was urgent, persuasive. Feldman listened, frowning.
Even should Carl tell the little that he knows, it is enough for them to suspect us. Australian intelligence organization is like a smart dog. Their agents sniff out smallest clue. We cannot take the risk, Gerard.
Feldman, convinced now, shook his head.
No, it's true, we cannot. But are you sure you can do it alone?
Brunston smiled. He had won.
Of course. It will be easy.
15 minutes later, Carl watched the 4-wheel drive move off with the boat, then hurried up to the house and into the bathroom. Pausing outside their bedroom door, he was relieved to hear Rita still breathing deeply, so continued on to the study. Down in the cave, Chris and Midge were both in the water, romping happily with the dolphins, when Chris noticed the lift going up.
Midge, someone's coming down and it might not be Carl. We'd better make sure and go into the side cave. Come on.
Although the tide was not yet high, the small cave entrance was already under water. Reaching it first, Chris waited to see Midge safely through before he followed. As the lift stopped, Carl could see the dolphins swimming around excitedly, but there was no sign of Chris. He must have waited until they'd gone, Carl thought, so he should be here any minute. But seeing Titch's tub empty, he knew Chris had already come down, and it wasn't until he noticed that Titch was not with the others that the penny dropped. Not being certain of who was in the lift, Chris had probably ducked into the side cave, and Titch must have followed him in. Carl grinned. He'd surprise them. Just as Carl dived into the pool, the lift behind him started to rise. He was halfway to the cave when Titch came out, chattering happily, then dived back through the entrance. Brunston, alone in the lift, spotted Carl just before it stopped, and in seconds had made up his mind. Throwing off his sandals, he raced up the steps and slid down by the step rails, burning the palms of his hands and landing awkwardly on the rock shelf below. Looking across, he realized there was no time to lose. Carl had already gone through into the tiny cave. Quickly stripping off his shirt and shorts, Brunston took a racing dive into the pool and swam with powerful strokes towards the submerged entrance. Reaching it, he quickly released the outside rope from its peg. And as he let it go, the steel door came screeching down, landing with a resounding bang, sealing off the cave. Chris and Midge stared at each other in horrified silence. They were trapped. Someone had released the door. Midge had been about to follow Carl out through the entrance when the door crashed down, and each knew there was no way the door could be raised from this side. Had it been Carl? It must have been Carl, they were both thinking, when he surfaced, his face white with shock.
"The peg that holds the rope," he gasped. "It must have pulled out from wall." "We can't get out, then," Midge's voice quavered as she looked at Chris. "Can we?" "Well, Bobo, you are having the special treatment today, yes?"
Bobo, lying quietly in his tub, appeared half asleep, and hardly reacted at all as Feldman poured cold seawater from a jerry can over the already wet toweling covering him.
"There, that will keep you cool for a little while."
Feldman glanced up to see Brunston hurrying down the track towards him. Showing no sign that he had seen him, Feldman put the jerry can down. He waited, seeing Brunston's triumphant grin spread as he came up to him.
"Is done, then?"
The question was almost nonchalant. Brunston's grin faded like a deflating balloon. Once again, he was not to be allowed any credit for his success. but this time he would not allow Gerard to belittle him. His grin returned. He would keep him guessing, he decided.
"Time and tide wait for no man," he quoted smugly. "And neither will wait for Karl Rimmer."
Feldman resisted the temptation to ask further questions, knowing that Brunston could not keep it to himself for long.
"Nor for us, Stefan," he said curtly, as he strode to the four-wheel drive and climbed into the driver's seat. "So I asked Chris to hold my letter back, Paul. I wanted to tell you myself."
Alan sat by his brother's bed in the hospital room they had shared since Paul had been released from intensive care.
"Well, I'm glad you're here to tell it, Alan. It's been great to have you with me, and losing the money means nothing," Paul grinned. "I'm alive, thanks to you."
"Would I be interrupting a family conference?" The brothers looked up to see Margaret Sinclair smiling in the doorway. Alan laughed.
"Of course not. Come in, Margaret."
"I can only stay a minute." "No, please don't get up, Alan," she protested as Alan half rose from his chair.
"You're still on our sick list, you know."
"Not for long, though," Alan grinned up at her.
"They're going to kick me out of here in a couple of days, so I'm told."
"Yes," Margaret laughed.
"But we won't be seeing the last of you," she smiled at Paul. "Will we, Doctor?"
Paul laughed.
"Don't be too sure. Alan's always loathed hospitals, ever since he was a kid."
"Well, the Tyrrell Street flat is ready and waiting, Alan. I came to tell you that. So, if Chris wants to move in tomorrow, you could go straight there from here."
"Oh, that sounds a splendid idea." Alan looked delighted. "Chris will jump at it, I know. He's away this weekend, but he'll be back sometime tonight."
"What time is it now, Chris?" Midge asked wearily through chattering teeth. She was shivering uncontrollably as she clung with the others to a ledge only centimetres from the roof of the cave.
2:45, Midge. Keep hanging on there. You too, Carl. Only quarter of an hour to go."
Chris tried to answer cheerfully, but he knew time was running out for the three of them. He delayed his decision until now, hoping the tide would turn before the cave had filled entirely. But they were using up oxygen in the only air pocket left, and the water level was still rising, too quickly for him to hope any longer. Titch, swimming slowly around them, nudged Chris again, but more urgently this time. The dolphin, except for several short absences, had stayed in the cave with them. And each time he returned, had nudged Chris gently, encouraging him. Chris knew Titch had been trying to show him something, but the underwater picture was still murky and full of shadows. Probably, he thought, because his own anxiety was blocking the brainwave frequency he needed to receive the transmission. He knew there was another hole under the entrance, but even at low tide it had always been filled with water and looked too small and forbidding to be explored. Undoubtedly it was the one that Titch was using to leave the cave. Chris sensed that going through that hole, and whatever lay below it, would be a difficult and dangerous undertaking for him. If he were alone, he would not have hesitated. But the thought that if he didn't make it, Midge and Carl would be left on their own to drown, stopped him. But now there was no option but to go with Titch, and if he left it any longer, they would all die, either by suffocation or drowning. "Titch obviously knows a way out of here," Chris told the others quietly. "He wants me to go with him."
"Oh, Chris, no," Midge wailed. "You'll be drowned."
"No, Titch thinks I can do it, and if I don't go now, it'll be too late for all of us."
The dolphin, sensing that Chris had decided, threw up his head and squeaked twice. Then, as Chris drew a deep breath, Titch dived, with Chris holding on to his dorsal fin with both hands. The hole, only a meter below the entrance, was barely wide enough for the two of them, and Chris felt sharp rocks scraping his back as he wriggled his way through for at least 3 meters. Then they were free, and inside the inky blackness of an underwater cave. But now the dolphin twisted and turned so much that Chris was finding it hard to keep a grip on his fin and hung on desperately. If they were separated, he knew Titch would collect him, but precious time would be lost.
Chris could still see nothing until they had entered a side tunnel. Now there was just enough light to see small fish darting in and out among the weeds, brushed aside by the current. And, as it grew lighter still, Chris knew this meant that they were nearing the open sea at last. His head was pounding, and he knew he couldn't last much longer. Then, just as his lungs seemed almost at bursting point, they came out of the tunnel and rose quickly to the surface. Gasping and exhausted, laughing with relief, Chris hugged the happily chattering dolphin.
"Oh, Titch, Titch, what a ride that was!"
Chris was relieved to see that the outer cave was only 20 meters away, and he had to get there and into the studio cave behind it, and quickly. Titch, sensing the urgency, had already headed off. But he came back, chattering, inviting Chris to hang on again, then sped off with him towards the cliff. The white cabin cruiser moved away from the boat ramp, out into the busy Newcastle harbour. Feldman at the wheel was seething. He'd been forced to wait until no one was around before launching. It being Sunday and perfect weather, there were too many boats and people about for his liking. If anyone suspected there was a dolphin aboard the boat, it would have invited unwanted curiosity. Brunston was sitting astern beside Bobo's tub, attempting to pacify him with taped music from the radio on the seat beside him, while keeping him covered with the wet toweling. For the past half hour, the dolphin had been bored and restless, and Brunston's patience was wearing thin. He did not think Gerard had sedated Bobo enough, and had said so, but Gerard, as usual, had scoffed at his stupidity.
"You think he do his job when half asleep, then?"
Feldman had now picked out the grey ship in the distance, berthed at the end wharf. She didn't look at all intimidating, he thought. Quite harmless, in fact. His thin lips stretched into a slow smile. But then, within the next hour, she would be perfectly harmless.
"We try for fish here," Gerard called as he slowed the engine. Then quietly, "Get line out, hoist tub. And don't forget towels."
Stefan lost no time, and soon a sturdy rod stood in its holder at the stern, and on the end of the line, 10 meters out, a bright lure was skipping over the water. When his toweling covers were removed, Bobo reacted with excitement, thinking it must be time for the game. But he accepted 2 fish as consolation. Now he watched with uncomprehending interest as a sturdy wire frame, its legs having been slotted into the 4 corners of the tub, was raised 60 centimeters and the legs tightened in place. Once again he was covered with the wet toweling. Then 2 large beach towels were thrown over the frame, blotting out all but his view of what was directly ahead. But Bobo quite enjoyed the jerky ride, as his tub on its board slowly came up until it was high enough for him to see out over the stern, and when it was turned sideways, he had an excellent and quite close view of the wharves as the boat passed them. Feldman and Brunston looked like 2 men out for a day's fishing, a tall, thin bloke with glasses, and a stocky bloke in a flowered shirt and squashed cotton hat, swigging nonchalantly at a stubby of beer, as he hung beach towels to dry on an improvised clothes hoist. Gerard looked back.
"You got a fish," he called elatedly as he cut the motor.
At once Stefan grabbed the rod and began to reel in the line, but he'd already loosened the tension on the reel so that it screeched every time he raised the rod high, releasing more line, the pull giving the rod a realistic bend, as if his catch was fighting back. Gerard had come astern to watch excitedly, but now, as he bent down in front of the clothes hoist, he looked across at the wharf from Bobo's line of vision. Yes, he could clearly see the grey hull of the ship, and towards the bow, just below the waterline mark, a dark red circle surrounding a small black one.
"You see the target, Bobo. Look well, Bobo," Gerard whispered, as he took an enlarged snapshot of the target sheet from his shirt pocket and held it for the dolphin to see. "Only that ship has target sign like this one. It is very special ship. Sign does not mean target to them, but it does to us. We play game soon, yes?"
He grinned, as Bobo peeped twice, nodding his head. The dolphin may have understood about the target, or was merely enjoying the attention. But there was no doubt at all in Feldman's excited mind. Bobo knew what he had to do. With their heads now only half a meter from the cave roof, Midge and Carl clung, gasping for breath, to a ledge high in the cave wall. A few minutes ago, Midge, drowsy from lack of oxygen, had momentarily lost her grip, but Carl had managed to grab her before she went under. Now he was behind her, his body braced against hers, both outstretched arms close around her head, which had now fallen back against his shoulder. "Hold on, if you can," he gasped. "Chris will come back, soon." To Midge, the words, coming from a long way off, seemed to float up, one by one, from her dream. But the words weren't right. Chris was here. She could feel him right behind her. She was safe now. Quite safe. With a long, contented sigh, Midge let go. As he felt her full weight, Carl almost lost his grip on the ledge, and the pain of strained arm muscles made him gasp. But somehow his numbed fingers held on. "I must keep awake. I must." Silently he repeated the words in an effort to fight off his own drowsiness until they became a slow, meaningless jumble in his confused brain. But still he hung on. Neither Carl nor Midge felt the dolphin's body slide gently under them both, taking their weight, and Carl barely heard the harsh grating sound of the metal door being pulled up from outside. Only when he found himself lying face down on the rock apron of the studio cave and coughing up seawater did Carl become fully conscious. Relieved to see Chris and Midge close by, he sat up. Midge, cradled in Chris's arms, was crying softly, her arms tight around his neck. Not wishing to intrude, Carl hugged his knees, rested his head on them, and closed his eyes, thankfully.
"Oh, Chris," Midge sobbed. "I thought you must be stuck down there. Drowned. I thought I'd never see you again."
Chris kissed her forehead gently, then pressed his cheek against hers.
"And I thought you'd gone when I brought you out. It was awful."
"Oh, Chris."
Midge brought her hands down to cup his face.
"I just love you," she sobbed. "Do you know that?"
she added, half embarrassed, then kissed him soundly before he had time to say anything.
"Wow," Chris, recovering, laughed down at Midge. "And do you know what? I love you too," he said.
"Good,"
Midge smiled as she sat up, wiping away tears as she looked across at Titch, who lay quietly in the water watching them.
"I love you too, Titch," she reached out her arm, inviting him. "But for you, we'd all be dead by now."
Titch, chattering happily, surged forward to slide up onto the rock ledge beside his friends. Half an hour later, they were in the Cliffhurst kitchen. Carl was busy preparing coffee. Midge, white-faced but chatting quite happily to Chris, sat with a mohair rug wrapped around her. Smiling to see the two of them holding hands, Carl brought a tray with four steaming mugs to the kitchen table and handed one to Midge.
"Here you are, coffee, hot and strong. We'll soon make you feel better."
"Thanks, Carl."
Midge took the mug gratefully. He grinned ruefully as he handed a mug to Chris.
"You saved my life, Chris. And all I give you is coffee."
Chris laughed.
"Well, hot coffee will save my life right now, I can tell you." "I take some now for Rita," Carl said, moving to the door. "She's awake now. Says much better," he added cheerfully as he went out.
"You look worn out, Midge," said Chris, concerned. "I can't let you sailboard home, even with me. Carl had better drive you home, and I'll come too, of course."
"No," Midge protested. "I'm quite okay now. Really, I am," she grinned. "And after this strong witch's brew, I'll be ready to fly off home on a broomstick."
Chris laughed, then looked thoughtful.
"Talking of flying off, I still can't understand how that rope came off its peg like that. The rope was so tight I could barely get it back on after I'd pulled the door up."
Midge shrugged, sipping her coffee.
"Well, that's the reason why it slipped off then. Someone didn't put the rope far enough on the peg when they opened it last."
"Yes, I suppose that was it. But Chris didn't sound entirely convinced. Strange that it had to happen today, though.
Well, a lot of very strange things happened today, didn't they?
Midge looked thoughtful.
I wonder where those two took Bobo. They didn't tell Carl, it seems.
Half a kilometre offshore, the white cabin cruiser lay at anchor. But the two men on board were only making a pretense at fishing, and did not exert themselves unless another boat passed very close to them. Several had anchored near them, no doubt hoping that the white boat was having some luck, but had soon moved on, thus saving them the bother of moving themselves. Having other boats around was the last thing Brunston and Feldman wanted right now. The music, Bobo's favourite kind, was not only keeping him comparatively quiet, but serving to drown out his occasional bursts of impatient chattering. He had never been subjected to such a long confinement, and saw no reason why he shouldn't voice his objection to it. Bobo was also hungry. Feldman, who had been looking through binoculars, suddenly put them down. "The ship. She has just passed through the breakwaters." Feldman spoke calmly, but the slight tremor in his voice belied it. Brunston grabbed the binoculars excitedly, but Feldman quickly put down his hand, staying him. "No, not now, Stefan," he reprimanded. "First, we prepare Bobo." Too excited to argue the point, Brunston snatched the beach towels from the frame. "Quick, you get the harness, then," he said. Removing the wet toweling from Bobo's tub, he began to unfasten the rubber strapping, and, by the time Feldman had brought the carton from the cabin, Brunston had the wire tub framed down. Bobo, being used to this procedure, lay quietly as he was carefully dressed in his harness and the straps buckled up, except for one strap, attached to the back of the head suction piece, the small two-pronged plug at its end being doubled back and held by a rubber band. Both men were particularly careful that this end was kept out of the water. Now Brunston stood back watching, as Feldman rechecked, making sure that each strap fitted snugly without being too tight, finally tucking the loose strap out of the way under the headpiece. Quickly, the two men placed the slide ready beside the tub, then hurried into the cabin to watch the approaching ship. Bobo, sensing the men's excitement, wriggled about in his tub, chattering happily. He would play the game very soon now.
"She is coming fast, Gerard,"
Brunston wiped nervously at his perspiring face.
"We are in the right position, too, I think."
"Yes," Feldman agreed.
"If she goes straight, as now, she will pass us to starboard, about 100 meters."
Brunston smiled.
"She hides her claws well. Nobody who looks at her would ever think she carries much new secret electronic equipment that can see, can hear, intercept, and destroy any missile.
And something else so new, so secret that even we do not know what it is," Gerard added.
"You think, when it is over, that Alex will tell us?"
Brunston asked, hopefully. Feldman did not reply at once. There would be no us, he was thinking. He would see to that soon. An unfortunate accident at Cliffhurst. Stefan was a fool. He had wanted Carl out of the way so he could have Rita to himself. But without Carl to stop her, Rita would talk her head off. So, Gerard decided, she must go as well. But he would think about that later.
"Perhaps," he answered quietly. "But it is nearly time," he added briskly, as he turned away. "You must feed Bobo now. Keep him happy, and he'll work well."
"But we are still too far ahead of the ship," Brunston protested. "Bobo won't see her."
"He'll not have to. You forget dolphins have their own sonar system," Feldman replied scathingly. "An echo will come back from the ship. Bobo will know just how far away the ship is. He'll go straight there."
Seeing the men had returned, Bobo sensed that it was time for the game at last. His waving tail fluke rattled against his tub as he chattered excitedly, nodding his head, and the two fish offered were happily gulped down. He even cooperated by wriggling onto the slide as his tub was tipped over, and stayed still when rolled on his side, knowing that in this position he could not move forward. Brunston watched, holding his breath, as Feldman removed the rubber band from the loose strap, then very carefully inserted the terminal into the socket above the cylinder, pushing it in until there was an audible click. Feldman and Brunston looked at each other. This was a big moment for them. But very soon, their really big moment, the culmination of all their hard work, would come. Wordlessly, the two men turned Bobo over on the slide. Brunston waited, ready to tilt it up. Bobo, facing the water, waited for the words to start the game. Feldman, eyes glittering, his gaunt face taut, took his hands from the dolphin.
Go, Bobo. Go. Find the target.
The slide tilted. The dolphin slid down into the water, spent a few seconds recovering his balance, then sped away. Bobo was 100 meters from the ship when he first picked up the high-pitched sounds and slowed his pace. He did not like them. The closer he got, the louder became the high-frequency noises, until they were painful to his acutely sensitive hearing. He came up then, swimming on the surface for the next 30 meters, so that his ear apertures were above the water. But when he dived again, he found the intense auditory pain from the screeching high-pitched noises so unbearable that he shot to the surface at once. Confused and frightened, Bobo swam in dazed circles. He did not like this part of the game at all. He wanted to play it the way he knew. Feldman and Brunston, tense-faced, watched the grey ship through the cabin windows. She was now 200 meters away and approaching fast. Feldman looked down at the stopwatch in his hand.
"Another 5 to 10 seconds, I think," he muttered between clenched teeth.
Brunston, his shaking hand wiping away sweat with a now sodden handkerchief, did not reply. When the second hand had reached 20, Feldman frowned.
"He should be there now. What's stopping him?"
It was then that Brunston let out a strangled cry, pointing.
"Look! Bobo! He's coming back!"
For a moment, Feldman stared in horrified disbelief, then shook his head, relieved.
"No, it's all right. The boat is fiberglass. There must be metal contact, remember, and the target sheet is not there."
Brunston, knowing that Bobo would do exactly what they'd trained him to do, almost screamed the words as he grabbed Feldman's arm.
"But the metal clip that held the target sheet to the boat! Gerard, it is still there! It's right in the center of where—"
But the word "target" was never uttered, as, with a horrendous booming roar, the white cabin cruiser disintegrated in a huge ball of bright orange flame that rose high into the air, carrying every part of the boat with it. There was nothing left to sink, only small charred pieces that dropped, hissing, into the sea. Death had come swiftly for two men, and sadly for an innocent, fun-loving dolphin, the pawn in their deadly game, who would play it no more. Epilogue. Chris played his pipes in the cave while Titch lay contentedly in his usual resting place, listening. It was mid-March now, and still warm after the long, hot summer. But soon the dolphins would leave the little bay and head north to spend the winter months in warmer waters, as always. Titch still mourned his friend, Bobo. Carl had told Chris that Titch had swum backwards and forwards distractedly, close to the launching ramp, until dark that Sunday, almost as if he guessed that Bobo was never coming back. So much had happened since that day, and now Chris and his father were back at Cliffhurst. 10 days after that fateful Sunday, Paul Manane had received a packet in the mail. Much to his amazement, it contained all the papers connected with the sale of the Cliffhurst property, and a covering letter, apparently from MMRI, and signed by Alexander R. Ledlow, director of the Institute. The writer expressed deep regret at the tragic death of two of their most valued staff members. Then went on, "It has now been decided that MMRI will not be continuing its research program in Australia. Therefore, the Institute would be happy to hand back the property purchased from you, Dr. Manane, as a gift, in acknowledgement of your very valuable contribution to mammal research. The letter concluded, "As the transfer of title has not yet been presented for processing, no legal adjustments will be necessary." Chris had been even more staggered by this turn of events than his father and Uncle Alan, and wondered if he could have been wrong in thinking Feldman and Brunston had been phonies after all. But a phone call from Paul Manane to MMRI in France soon proved him right. The director of the institute, who was not Alexander R. Ledlow, knew nothing of any property purchase by MMRI in Australia. He'd never heard of either Gerard Feldman or Stefan Brunston, and neither had ever been members of the staff. He sympathized with Dr. Manane's feelings in the matter and suggested that if there had been fraudulent use of the Institute's name, corporate affairs should be notified and the matter investigated. So, which organization Feldman and Brunston had worked for, and what it was that they'd been sent to do at Cliffhurst, was still a complete mystery. No papers or records of any kind had been found, not even in the two locked desk drawers. Carl knew papers had been kept there, but thought someone must have removed them a few days after the accident, when he and Rita had gone down to Newcastle. Carl had been questioned by the police, and surprisingly, by two men from ASIO, puzzled, they said, by the unusual severity of the explosion on the boat. But the only reason Carl could give was the large amount of extra fuel the boat was carrying that day. Carl said the ASIO men hadn't seemed too convinced at the time. But if ASIO had uncovered anything since then, they were keeping quiet about it, as no further contact had been made. Well, it was certainly a mystery, Chris thought, as he played his pipes. But it was over now, and best forgotten. He could only feel very glad to be back at Cliffhurst, and that his father was alive and almost well again, thanks to Uncle Alan. It was over a month now since Uncle Alan had returned to his London flat, looking forward to next August, when Margaret Sinclair would be flying over to holiday with her grandparents. And Midge would soon be coming up to Outer Bay for the Easter holidays. Chris stopped playing and smiled, picturing Midge's laughing face when they met again. Titch squeaked twice and nodded his head. Chris grinned down at him. "Want me to keep playing, Titch?" he teased. "Or are you looking forward to seeing Midge as well? Which of the two is it, eh?" And as Titch chatted excitedly, smacking at the water with his flippers, Chris threw up his head and laughed, knowing that Titch was saying yes to both questions. This is the end of The Dolphin Connection by Beryl Bainbridge. Your narrator has been Anna Brunoski, with production by Gillian Bartlett. Following is a biographical note about the author. Beryl Bainbridge was born at Tatura in Victoria. As B. Colchin, she co-founded the Children's Arena Theatre and has published musicals, poetry, and short stories. The Dolphin Connection is her first published novel. She now lives at Bonny Doon and enjoys fishing.
Production and copyright announcement. This Daisy book was created by the Vision Australia Information Library Service in 2006. This recording is copyright. No unauthorised copying, broadcasting or public performance is permitted. This concludes the recording.